Say You'll Haunt Me from Stone Sour, the number one song in rock for the fourth straight week in a row. We will see you next week on the Sideshow Countdown, where we're going to have more of the biggest songs in rock, hand-picked tracks by me for you. I'm Nikki Six.
I'm Carrie Casey.
And we'll see you next weekend.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead, stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF.
That's 313-298-9743.
Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. It's another Sunday night in the Motor City. Peter Werby and cue the crickets. Julene Jordan, back. She was gone last week. She was out at the Jackass 3D opening. Wanted to hear all about that. We actually got a phone call from her at about 12:15 when she just landed in Detroit. She's going to tell us the whole story tonight, and as well as taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF. And suddenly her voice went. She said she was going to call and just give people an idea of how bad her voice actually was. Let me attest to it, folks, that her voice is pretty bad. In fact, I'm worrying about mine. I don't know. I mean, you know, it starts to, what I call the Godfather effect starts to creep up on me. So it begins to talk more and more, you know, like that famous character in that movie. But hold on. I'm going to do something off mic. There you go. Okay. Well, here's what we're going to do, though. Julene is extraordinarily disappointed. Here was an email she sent me earlier. She said, I can call in at the beginning of the show to give them an idea how bad off my vocal cords are. I am so bummed, she says. 2 weeks in a row is almost unbearable. Being home will make me talk less off air, too, I mean being at her house as well. All right, so here's what we're going to do, though. We've been encouraging you to go to the Night Call Facebook page, and that is just facebook.com/nightcall. You know how to spell that, right? NIGHTCALL. Julene is going to be listening, and she is going to be monitoring our Facebook page, and she is going to add people to Facebook who haven't signed up yet, and she, in fact, she says you'll personally add them. She will comment on a few things during the show, and listeners can comment back, and so, you know, here we are, 21st century. It's good for me to kind of get into this decade or whatever. Actually, we're into the second decade, aren't we? And she says she will email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. calltalkyes@yahoo.com, which is our email address. Boy, got too many things to do here, huh? All right. In the meantime, this is a talk show. It's a political, social, whatever. Cultural talk show, and we give our opinions, and now, you know, I'm saying the royal we, I guess, because Jalene's not here, and then I take your calls at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. So again, you can go to facebook.com/nightcall, and Jalene will we'll get updates from her as the show progresses, although as usual we're having a little bit of technical difficulties. But Stephanie, who will take your calls at 313-298-WRIF, has been extraordinarily helpful in getting this rolling. Well, this election is coming, and it dominates a lot of the news cycles, right? Although, what do you bet it'll be? Maybe the turnout will be around 40%. So 60% of... Now, is it registered voters? There's always a debate about that when they say that 65% of the people voted like in the last election, which was extraordinary. You know, in some countries, 85-90% vote. Americans routinely ignore the polls because, any number of reasons. So lethargy, disgust, this feeling that it's Tweedledee and Tweedledumber. At the polls, but there are choices. And Noam Chomsky, the social critic, who said the farther you are away from the centers of power, the more who's in power determines a lot about your life. In other words, if you're someone like me, a white middle-class man, you're less affected. Now, I'm trying to say you're not affected, but you're a lot less affected, say, than if you're a poor person, a woman, person of color, people in, you know, third world and what have you. Then the policies really have a lot more impact. For instance, you know, the war in Iraq. Did that affect me? Well, you know, it stole billions and billions and billions, tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars from the national treasury in that sense, and in many ways set the context for the economic collapse that Bush presided over. Pardon me. And things like his tax cut for the wealthy. But right here at home, there wasn't anything palpable, wasn't anything that really I could touch. I mean, there was an ethical and a moral outrage at the tens of thousands of deaths, hundreds of thousands of deaths that have occurred because of this big Bush lie. And one of the things I think we have to look at when we're talking about these elections goes back to this phrase I've been using a lot lately, and that power, what is power? Power is the ability to define reality. Power is the ability to define reality. I mean, power is also the ability to send troops into your home and shoot it up. It's the ability to have, because you've broken a law or you are saying the wrong thing at the wrong time to the wrong person, to send the police in to arrest you, depending on the country, and even sometimes in this country. You come out and you protest, like in Minneapolis during the Republican National Convention in 2008, and thousands and thousands of people arrested illegally by the Minneapolis police because they didn't like what you were saying. They didn't like the mode of discourse. You know, they wanted you to be quieter. But just tons of people who were protesting in a nonviolent way were just scooped up. And, of course, then the people of Minneapolis, besides paying tens of millions of dollars for police protection that wasn't needed. There's always this hysteria about demonstrations. You think about the ones in Toronto recently, this summer, where Toronto spent $1 billion on security to protect the leaders of the G8 countries, all the, you know, the big shot countries. Well, let's get a little into what we're talking about here with the elections. This is, I think, extraordinarily important. Power as the ability to define reality. Now, here's a headline from AP, Associated Press. Those craving for change now look to the GOP. The GOP, that's not the great oil party, but the grand old party, as it's been called, the Republicans. Those craving for change now look to the Republicans, according to this. Here's the first line. President Barack Obama's winning coalition from 2008 has crumbled, and its core backers are dispirited. It's now Republicans who stand to benefit from an electorate that's, again, craving change. Okay. So that's sort of the prevailing wisdom. Something happened. At the grassroots, there was this right-wing revolt, this far-right-wing conservative revolt in the form of the teabaggers. And they, though, were in many ways were the tip of the iceberg, the dissatisfaction with the Barack Obama administration, that things didn't change in the manner that people had hoped. The jobs didn't come back. The housing market didn't come back. The foreclosures didn't stop. The wars continued. People had concerns about the health care bill and what have you. All right. And so now they are fleeing the Democratic Party into the arms of the Republican Party, who are going to sweep Congress. Okay, that's the prevailing wisdom. That's what you hear on every single news channel, every single newspaper, every single magazine. And, I mean, talk about a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, let's talk about the trajectory of all this. And that is that, first off, this far right-wing revolt that Looney Tunes personified. In these teabaggers, all the crazoids on the right get hysterical because the Democrats have won, and although they'll deny this to their dying day, that a man from African-American ancestry won. I mean, I don't even want to get into whether these people are racist or not. They are, they aren't. In some ways, it doesn't even matter. But I think what they saw was, when you talk about crumbling, that the old order that they thought gave some permanence and legitimacy to their lives was suddenly beginning to drift away. And, of course, there was this, what was happening in the land. I mean, created by the man that they, to a person, to a man and a woman, supported. What I'm talking about is every one of these teabaggers, with very, very few exceptions, supported George W. Bush. They supported all his wars. They supported all his tax breaks for the rich. They supported the giveaway of the energy legislation to the companies that wrote them. Remember the energy bill that was written by Enron in secret sessions? You're going, what? No, I don't remember that. Oh, it's ancient history, I think, because it probably happened in, 1,000 years ago. What was it, 2001 or something like that? Anyway, so you have this militant far-right-wing minority that doesn't really represent jillions of people, but it coalesced. It's what one person called the crazed hordes of the middle class. These were the people, in fact, particularly these white middle-aged men, who were suffering the least under what their president, George W. Bush, had created. Yet they were the angriest. They were the ones, take back America and started, get your guns and all that happy crapperoo, right? The ones that were suffering the least were the most angry. It's like this whack job teabagger in New York that's running for governor, a guy named Palladino, whose slogan is, we're angry too. What's he angry? He's a multimillionaire. He's made millions and millions off of the New York State government. But in fact, I want to get to him a little later. All right. So here, suddenly, this far right wing coalition of not great numbers of American people, I think, what is it, like 17%, coalesce. They have demonstrations. They've got media outlet. They've got this whole channel that's devoted to them. And it doesn't matter about reality. You've heard me say a lot of times, remember, 600 of these teabaggers assemble in Nashville. 1,000 media representatives come. The left, the progressives, the liberals turn out 15,000 people for a very similar event in Detroit in June. And probably 80% of you never even knew that it occurred. Most of the people, because they never got any media representation, because power is the ability to define reality. So the medium, remember, media is plural, the medium between reality and you is all of the electronic devices and still some of the print media as well. It tells you teabaggers really represent a strain of anger in the American body politic. The left, the progressives, no, they're nobody, even though there were so many of them. All right, so this begins to snowball. Suddenly, where everybody's angry. Well, people are pretty concerned, and well, they should be. Let me take away the modifier. People are concerned. People are very concerned. Well, we should be concerned. What has been done to our nation is criminal. The major criminals, of course, were in the Bush administration. The criminality revolving around the war in Iraq ought to be enough to bring criminal indictments in the world court for Bush and Cheney and the rest of these gangsters that got us into this war, and is probably going to wind up costing us $1 to $3 trillion because of this all. So when somebody like Barack Obama tries to fix it, it doesn't come up with much. For instance, the health care. I mean, what we really needed was a single-payer universal health care, like every other industrial country has, or some variant of that, where everybody gets health care as a matter of right, as a matter of being a citizen. You walk in, no, none of that thing the government says, you've got to buy it. I don't like that at all. That's in there because that was the best the Democrats could do. I don't even know where that's going. So as things increase, the people are villainized, like Nancy Pelosi, the House of Representatives, the Speaker of the House of Representatives. I mean, so she has become this, I don't know what you call it, this all-purpose demon, where any number of Democrats are saying, oh, we don't support her, and I would vote against her. I mean, what's this woman done, except carry out the Democratic Party program? So what has become a self-fulfilling prophecy becomes reality. And, well, let me put it another way. It's not really self-fulfilling. It's a prophecy that's been inserted into the discourse with nothing else allowed to say, wait a minute. You know, there's other realities here. So this has become reality, though. Here, so let me get back to this article. Those craving for change now look to the Republicans. President Barack Obama's winning coalition from 2008 has crumbled. Well, for one thing, it hasn't really crumbled. The coalition hasn't. And his core backers are dispirited. Well, many of it, well, I don't know if I was his backer, I voted for him, but I didn't. None of this has particularly surprised me. But they are dispirited because they thought more was going to happen. Of course, Barack Obama was hamstrung at every juncture by the Republicans because they have a couple of concerns. One of them is returning to political power. I'll talk about the other one in a minute. Now it's Republicans who stand to benefit from an electorate that's, again, craving change. Well, what's the change they're craving? They think they're going to get it with the Republicans? Well, let's think about that as well. Or if you, by the way, if you're just joining us, give us a call, 313-298-WRIF. Tell me about the change you crave. Well, I mean, all right, I'm going to let you do it. Nearly 2 years after putting Obama in the White House, one quarter of those who voted for the Democrat are defecting to the Republicans or considering voting against the party in power this fall. But just half of them say they'll definitely show up November 2nd. However, now, remember the headline here. Those craving for change now look to the Republicans. It says, yet, in a reflection of broad dissatisfaction with politics, just as many people who backed Republican presidential nominee John McCain are either supporting Democrats now or still considering how to vote. So it's a wash. That's not what we hear, is it? The Democrats are just toast. And, well, they may be. They well may be. They're talking about losing 55 seats, which that's not unusual in midterm elections. But there is something a little different here, right, than everything we've heard. Just as many people who backed Republican presidential nominee John McCain are either supporting Democrats now or still considering how to vote as the people who say they're dissatisfied with Obama. This is pretty interesting. It's a wide enthusiasm gap that's buoying Republicans who are poised for big electoral gains. So why are they poised for big electoral gains, given the language of this article in the Associated Press, if just as many people are thinking about switching to the Democrats who previously voted for McCain? Obama's party hopes its superior get-out-the-vote operation, updated from his groundbreaking campaign, can overcome Republicans' energized supporters to mitigate expected losses across the board. Again, what this is, power has the ability to define reality. So that's what all this media stuff is doing. I mean, by now, it could, in fact, come true. Why do you think, well, let me start in another direction. This is what always happens. Republicans are in office, and people go, oh, I made such a mistake. I mean, how could we have ever voted for this guy Bush? I mean, he ruined everything. He ruined the economy, got us into these wars that are reckless and draining the economy, killed all these Americans, killed all these Iraqis and Afghans, and we're mired in this war now. The country's in debt. It did have a surplus on when Bush came in. The guy ruined everything. Let's get Barack Obama in. All right? So Barack Obama gets in, and guess what? This Republican depression, it's depression for everybody except for the ultra-wealthy, their stock market's over 11,000 and all that, but the people that worked their butts off, well, let me put it this way, the people that caused it, they're making lots of money now, the people that worked hard, you and me, the rest of us, our families, our parents, our children, whoever, they're the ones that are suffering. They're the ones that are losing their house. The guys that really ruined it all, that were so greedy that they had no concern for anyone other than their own stockholders or themselves with these huge bonuses and all that, they come out smelling like a rose. A few of them got hurt, you know, but the majority, the class, that ruling class, that and represented by the political class, they came out just fine. It's the ordinary person. So the ordinary person says, well, gee, nothing got any better under the Republicans, so at least there's a section. Most people aren't going to change at all, by the way. We're talking maybe 15% of the people that are kind of up for grabs. They go, well, the Democrats didn't do it. Well, maybe I should go vote for the Republicans because They don't like Barack Obama, and I liked him, but now nothing's changed, so now I don't like him. And besides, there's all these negatives about him. But anyways, I don't know why, but I don't like them anymore, so we're going to vote for the Republicans. All right? To some extent, given how bad everything's going, the Democrats would almost do well to lose the House and the Senate, give it all over to these guys. And by 2012, everybody will go, wow, man, those Republicans sure screwed everything up again. We'll go back to the Democrats. But I'm not giving them any strategy. But here is what I got a couple of emails on this. By the way, you're listening to Night Call on WRIF. I'm Peter Werby. Jolene Jordan is out for the night. But if you're a Facebook user, you can go to Facebook.com/Night Call. Jolene is there. She's going to be adding friends to the Night Call Facebook page, and she's going to comment on some of the things that are being said, and you can comment back to her as well. You can do that at any time during the broadcast. So when you look at these far right-wing nut jobs that the Republicans have put up, like Michelle Bachmann, who is a representative now, who raises $5.5 million in the third quarter of this cycle, Sharon Engel, who's running against Senate Majority Leader Democrat Harry Reid in Nevada, raises $14 million. This woman in Connecticut, head of the Wrestling Federation, who's the Republican, who uses almost $120 million of her own money. Is there anyone out there, including some of you people who are going to vote the Republicans, that actually think that their interest is good governance? That all these extraordinarily wealthy people, these corporations, including foreign ones, that are dumping tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars into the political arena for the Republicans, do you think they really care that there's good governance? And do you think they really care about you, the working class guy or the middle class woman or the man and woman or anywhere other than themselves? Don't you really think they just think you're dumb and that you're cannon fodder for their economic and political goals? Here's what it's all about. We know about the Koch brothers, K-O-C-H, right? And the millions and millions they put into right-wing causes. Here's something else called the American Future Fund. It's a conservative organization in Iowa. It's been one of the great contributors, spending millions of dollars on ads attacking Democrats across the country. And they're engaged in the battle to control Congress. And it doesn't identify its donors, because you don't have to do that anymore, thanks to the Supreme Court, the right-wing Supreme Court. But how about this? The American Future Fund interviews found that the group was started with seed money from at least one influential Iowa businessman, Bruce Rastetter. He's a co-founder and chief executive of one of the nation's largest ethanol companies, Hawkeye Energy Holdings, and a rising force in state Republican politics. And hints of a possible agenda emerge from a look at the politicians on the American Futures Fund's hit list. Now, this is who they're after. Most have seats on a handful of legislative committees with a direct say in the ethanol industry. So what they're talking about, the Koch brothers, this guy, the Chamber of Commerce, all of them, a few of you are going to change your mind. And the ones of you that are inexplicably, wedded to this party of the ultra wealthy, even though you're nothing like them, they wouldn't even sit at a table with you. You might be in the same restaurant, clearing the dishes off their table or something like that. But these are the people whose desire to control Congress through the Republican Party is solely to enrich themselves greater, and to do so by eliminating as many controls on them as possible, to get rid of the regulations in the energy field. And that's where, we need it the most, because these guys are poisoning us for profit. It's Murder Incorporated. These damn energy companies, what they're doing to our air and our water and our land. So they're going to launch all of these negative ads, pay for tens of millions of dollars, I guess it's up to hundreds of millions of dollars now, so they can get their cronies in. But they need you. They need you, the average man and the average woman, the average middle-class person that lives in Royal Oak and Southgate and stuff like that. And they're going to pull your chain about the Democrats. Oh, they're socialists, and they're doing this and they're doing that, right? And what are they going to do? not quite clear, is it? Well, one of the things they're going to do is they're going to go back and do what Bush did, is unchain these monstrous industries and corporations that destroyed the economy. And for those of you who would go and vote for these guys, I just don't even know what to say. I got these emails that objected to me to say anybody that did that was stupid. You're cutting your own throat. You're cutting the throat of your family, your neighborhood, and your community, and your country, and the world, probably, when it comes to stuff like pollution. There's a group called Think Progress, thinkprogress.org, and they have this story about the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's foreign fundraising operation. And they've been raising money from foreign-owned businesses, they finance its unprecedented $75 million partisan attack ad campaign. So here's the Chamber of Commerce that is doing everything it can to destroy the Democratic Party, right, politically. So, boost the Republican candidates to office. Is there really some of you out there that think their intent is, the good governance of this country or of this state or wherever they're spending these corporations' money? Do you really think the corporations care about you? Do you really think the Chamber of Commerce thinks, gee, if we just get our way cleared, that we don't have any controls on the way our financial institutions are operated? Remember, that's what happened under Bush, that everything will be good for Joe and Jane, middle class and working class. I mean, are you really that dumb? I mean, I hope not. They documented three different ways. The Chamber of Commerce is saying this is just slander and they're not doing it. Here's what they do. You know, it's illegal for foreign corporations or for candidates to accept money from foreign corporations. But they have this internal fundraising program called Business Councils, which they solicit direct, largely foreign contributors to the Chamber. They have direct contributions from foreign multinationals like BP, Siemens, and Shell Oil, and from the Chamber's network of what they call AmCham affiliates, which are foreign chambers of commerce composed of American and foreign companies. The Chamber quickly acknowledged that it receives direct foreign money, but simply replied, quote, "We are not obligated to discuss our internal procedures." And what they've done is they've vowed to put more money into these battleground states, another $10 million, right? Other organizations that participate in elections receive foreign money. They are required to isolate those funds so they don't get used for political purposes. Foreign companies with U.S. divisions also can create political action committees that accept donations from their U.S. employees. So you're being scammed, and you're going for it? I mean, a few of you. I don't think most of you. It's like I say, probably 42% of people on each side of things aren't going to change at all, but some of you are. All right, this got everybody going. Craves change. Okay, everybody wants to talk about craving change. Well, let me do this. Every one of you, and I got to lean way over here. Ron and Dave and Marshall and Carrick and John and Jim, stay right there, and I'll be right back, and we'll get your calls after these.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
This is Matt Demmer from Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury. I'm here to tell you that now it's more important than ever to buy an American-made vehicle. We at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury are still in the business of leasing and want to help you. Whether you're looking for the hot new Lincoln MKS, the sleek Lincoln MKZ, or the hottest crossover vehicle, the Lincoln MKX, Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. At our dealership, we believe in honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. We encourage you to check out our virtual showroom on our website, Demmer.com. You can check out our vehicle inventory, and you can bet that if we don't have the vehicle you're in the market for, we'll do our very best to get it for you. While you're online, we invite you to get a no-obligation internet price quote. Whether you come into our newly renovated dealership or visit us online, we at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury invite you to experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood in Dearborn. Give us a call today, 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com.
Welcome to the REI Fall Sale. How may I help you?
Well, I'm looking for a lightweight running
REI AirFlight hoodie.
Yes, and some ultra-comfortable
Oslo Moran Gore-Tex hiking boots.
You guessed it. Oh, and a
REI Lookout 40-pack.
Okay, this place is great.
We know what you need because we know what you love. Shop REI's fall sale October 8th through 17th and save up to 30% on outdoor gear and clothing. Plus, members get 20% off on full-priced items. Exclusions apply. Visit REI or REI.com. REI. Find out.
Feels like time's running out. Maxed out on your credit cards, collection calls are coming every day, and you're two payments behind on your mortgage. You need help. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. Call Credit Card Relief right now. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. Call 866-290-8282. That's 866-290-8282.
Water is all around us. No wonder it's hard to imagine we're facing a water crisis. But we are. So that's why the American Planning Association brings you simple ways to save water at home and in your community. Learn more at planning.org. That's planning.org. A public service message from this station and the American Planning Association.
Detroit's Rock Station 101, The Riff.
If you want a new computer but think you can't get credit, think again. Just call Tronics Country right now. No matter what your credit status is, now you can own a brand new desktop or laptop computer. Your approval is guaranteed as long as you have an active checking account and can afford small weekly payments. With Tronics Country, there's no credit check. You will not be turned down. Call right now and order your new computer. You'll also get a free color printer and a free digital camera. Just call 800-990-2258. But that's not all. Call right now and you'll also get a free 22-inch high-definition TV with your paid purchase. You heard right. A free TV with your new computer. All you need is an active checking account and your approval is guaranteed. Don't wait. Call Tronics Country right now. Call 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents lime scale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back. Jolene Jordan out with laryngitis. Wow, we miss her. Second week in a row. And she's at home, though. She's monitoring the show, inviting everybody to go to the Night Call Facebook page. Just go to facebook.com/nightcall. She will add you as a friend. You can comment on things as the show goes along. She will reply, even send me stuff. So let's go right to our phones. Here's Ron in Warren. Ron, hi, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for joining me on WRIF.
Yeah, hey, Pete. I took great offense to your teabag, your teabagger or whatever you're calling us. I'm a Tea Party person. I followed your show from the beginning. I mean, I'm friends with Art, John O'Leary, Steve Costan. I've been around for a long time, and I'm really, really upset with that teabagger. I'm an independent. I don't like any party, not the Democrats, not the Republicans. I love this country. I love the Constitution, and, you know, we're fighting us little people against the elitist establishment.
Man, you are being financed by the elitist establishment, by the people that own you. You ought to go listen to George Carlin. They own you. That's who's financing the teabaggers. By the way, that was what they originally called themselves. They're so stupid. They didn't understand the double meaning of that. And, hey, I just keep calling them that. And if you're offended...
Nobody's financing the Tea Party. We are a grassroots organization. We are throwing the elitists out.
You are dreaming, Ron. You know, this is the mythology that somehow that these ordinary folks got together. They are financed with hundreds of millions of dollars of the richest people in the world. I mean, Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama, man, they're closer to you and me than the people that are and they are up in an elite category. I'm not trying to say they are, but they're closer to you and me than the people who are putting down the dollars to get these Republicans in office. And but regardless of that, what are these big changes that these teabaggers are going to make if they ever get into office? Are you with me?
I'm telling you, Nancy Pelosi is an idiot.
Well, you know, that's well reasoned. Why? What makes her an idiot,
you
Ron?
You are a leftist. A leftist dinosaur.
Well, tell me, why is she an idiot, and why
you
am
never
I?
Never talk about Republicans in a good sense.
Well, I have nothing good to say, but I don't have much good to say about most Republican politicians. But they don't mean well, Ron. You are their cannon fodder to get the rich back into power. Do you realize that?
No, I'm not.
Well, yes, you are. Tell me why Nancy Pelosi is an idiot.
Look at the candidate in Delaware.
Yeah.
She can't, there's nothing wrong with her. She is a Tea Party candidate.
Well, she's not a witch. I agree.
Exactly. But that's the kind of people, normal people we're trying to put. The guy, Joe Miller, that, you know, he, in Alaska, he, you know, we want to get.
That was the guy. Wait a minute. You think they ought to get rid of Social Security the way Joe Miller thinks?
You know what?
What?
Me and you are not going to get Social Security. It's broke.
It's not broke. I mean, you know what? Ron, I'll tell you, you are so confused, you are so misinformed, that it really does you a disservice to continue to speak publicly. Let me tell you. Let me end the call. And, wow. You know, that's another one of the myths. Social Security is not broke. It's never missed a payment in 40 years. What is beginning to run out is the surplus. And again, we could easily fix everything could be fixed if we cut the war budget by about 3/4, ended these wars immediately and all that. But even if you want to do that, if you want to keep spending $1 trillion a year on wars and hundreds of bases across the United States and all that, even if, you know, if you think that's a real good idea, one of the ways we could save Social Security from the drastic fate that these disinformation folks put out there is remove the cap on the FICA tax. Right now, you make over $108,000. That's all you pay. So talk about an unfair tax. If you make $27 million, you make, you know, these are the people that are funding the teabaggers. If you make $27 million a year, you pay FICA tax on $108,000. If you make $50,000 a year, you pay it on your entire salary. So we could fix that easy enough. Anyway, let's continue on. Here's Marshall in Monroe, the home of Fermi II and George Custer, General George Custer. Go ahead. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
Hey, I just wanted to, I guess I'm what you consider a Republican that's hoping for a change of a better time.
Okay.
And I think a time for everybody that we can all agree on that would be a better time to live in would be when you're not such a douchebag. I love you, Dominic.
Oh, man. This, you know, I recognize that voice, too. So I love you, Dominic. All right. Let's go to John. John is in Dearborn. Go ahead, John. You're on the air. I could, you know, by the way, I could, two things before, John, let me just hold you up. When you call in, your number shows up on caller ID. Okay, that's number one. Number two, I don't even bother. And I have a little button here. You're on like a 20-second delay. So anything you say, I could just clip out. But I don't care. You just sound stupid. And sometimes it's funny, even. But so I let that go. John, hi. It's Peter Werbe on WRIF. Thanks for joining me. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How's it going?
Going good.
I just wanted to say in respect to what type of change you crave, I crave a type of change that doesn't involve either of the two major parties. I think it's gotten too crazy in the United States where every few years you go from one party, say, well, they're not working, let's go to the Republican Party, and so on and so forth, back and forth. Each party is equally incompetent in one respect. I mean, the Republican Party is more incompetent in a corruption sense or criminally incompetent, while the Democrats just can't get things done. They had a 60-seat majority in the Senate. They had a majority in the House. They had their president in. And sure, they promote the idea of universal health care and all that stuff that a lot of Americans want, but they just haven't been able to get it done. And I think that if you're craving things like single-payer health care or a living wage or reducing the military budget by a reasonable amount, you just can't go to either of those parties.
Well, I'll tell you, what happens, though, is everybody has what I always call this. I mean, there's different kind of blackmails, and there's the political blackmail. Like, for instance, I got a message from Joyce. She sent this in. This is, it goes exactly to what you're saying, John. She says that Sandra Levin in the 12th District of Michigan, you know, for goes across the east side in Huntington Woods, Royal Oak, or not Royal Oak, but rather Oak Park, Ferndale, places like that, says that that Sandra Levin has just almost voted like, well, let me hear. I'm going to do her an injustice. She says, like most of us who've worked for peace, that you've spent many years faithful to the Democratic Party. And like us, you must shudder at the thought of warmongering Republicans retaking the House next term. Fortunately, Sandra Levin is in no danger of losing his seat. And fortunately, there is a candidate in our district who is solidly against the war. Vote for the 12th District Green Party candidate, Julia Williams, and make Sandra Levin rethink the congressional votes that caused us to cringe. Well, I am going to vote for the Green Party candidate and not for Sandra Levin, and I hope to hell he loses. I couldn't care less whether this guy, who is good on a lot of other issues, on labor issues, he's good on, you know, civil liberties and civil rights, but he might as well be a Republican the way he votes on issues of like the war budget. So, but here's the deal. Here's the deal, John. I'll probably get calls. He said, you're going to let somebody really terrible in like the Republicans. And I'll think, oh, maybe they're right. So it's this blackmail. If you don't vote for the Democrats, then the horrible Republicans are going to get in, right?
I know what you're saying. I'm a relatively young person. I'm only 18. This will be my first voting year. But I remember Ralph Nader, when he said back in 2000, there wasn't, along the lines of at least, there wasn't dimes worth of difference between the two major parties. They slaughtered him. They just tore them apart. They went crazy. But if you really look at the voting records, I mean, the Democrats, they allowed the Iraq War. They allowed the $700 billion bank out of these crooks on Wall Street. They haven't gotten health care through. It's just hard to believe that there really is any significant difference between the two parties.
Well, I think there is. I think there's like about 40 cents worth of difference, and preferably the Democrats. But what we need is a dollar. And a party like the Green Party, if you look up, if you just Google Michigan Green Party, and you look at their platform, and you go, yeah, well, whoa, I agree with all of that. That makes a lot of sense. And one of the slogans, I think I said it last time, was that it's better to vote for something you want and not get it than vote for something you don't want and get it. And we keep getting Tweedledee and Tweedledummer. Tweedledummer being the Republicans, in my estimation. But we don't move forward very much. And you're right. Both parties are complicit in things like the bailout and things like the wars and what have you. So, you know, so what do we do? I mean, I'll tell you what most people do, John, is most people stay home. The majority of people are not going to vote in this election, no matter how much, they think, even almost like $1 billion is going to be spent on this election. And they couldn't care if 12% of the people turned out. I mean, if they can determine those votes by the injection of this obscene amount of money into determining who is going to win. I mean, people have been talking for generations about a realignment of parties, so that you really have a conservative party and you have some sort of left party, you know, liberal or radical or something like that. But we're not moving forward, and we're beginning to circle the drain on so many different levels. All right, thank you very much for your call. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number, and here is Carrick. He's in Redford. Hi, Carrick. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Well, to be honest, I think the thing that needs to change right now is, and as harsh as it is to say, this whole we're foregoing foreclosures on houses. We're trying to give people extensions, and extensions are turning into letting people keep their houses. What does that say to the person who, and I use this term loosely, the responsible people? The people who are paying their mortgages on time, the people who are paying their house payments, who are paying their bills, who aren't losing their homes. What does that say? It's the same thing that was done about the bailout programs.
Well, look at it like this, is what I said earlier. The people who created this financial mess in the first place and led this country down the economic drain, they're not suffering. And the people, for instance, I suppose if we look here, let me just read this to you. Total of almost 300,000 properties were lost to foreclosure in the July-September quarter. Banks have seized more than 816,000 homes for the first 9 months of the year and have been on pace for 1.2 million homes being seized by banks through foreclosure through 2010. Now, all those people weren't like irresponsible, negligent layabouts that just said, oh, man, I'm not paying my note. They were ruined financially because they were laid off. When you look at the unemployment figures, of course, you see very easily why people have lost their homes. They were also sold a bill of goods I would see people I know would buy homes for $650,000. And I said to them, are you crazy? I'd look at this house and I'd say, man, the workmanship is so bad on it. Materials are so cheap and all of that. And they go, oh, it doesn't matter, you know, because it'll be worth $1 million in 3 years, because that was the zeitgeist. That was the spirit of the times buy now, you know, and we can, you know, everything is upward and onward, and we're going to see the Dow at 30,000 and all of that. But even that, I never fell for that. You could say, well, people that were really smart didn't fall for that. But the people that were homeowners, people that have been in their homes for 20 years, that suddenly lost their jobs because of these banksters and these other corporate greed heads that ruin the economy, and the politicians like Bush and his cronies, you know, every one of them is made out great. None of them have lost their house. Who have lost their house is the average person who didn't do anything and were good citizens, worked hard, did their jobs, paid their note, and suddenly the rug was pulled out from under them.
What I'd love to see is the percentage of new homeowners, new home buyers in that time that were irresponsible in terms of buying those $650,000 a year. People who maybe make average income to who are maybe in the poor status. And I'd like to see.
Well, nobody got nobody. That, you know, the poor, they got $100,000 houses and what have you. And again, this was the desire that was that was created and said, hey, we don't care what you're making, we don't care what your credit is, and we would like to not live in a society where it has to be buyer beware. I mean, no interest loan, and interest only loans, all of these things that were being offered up, that were being advertised on this station. I would listen to them and I'm saying, how can this be? I mean, what's going on here? This sounds crazy to me. Hey, I know friends of mine that, they're not rich, but they, we would call them, average person would call them rich. I mean, in the 90s, in the end of the 90s, they were telling me, you got to put, you know, all your 401k, Pete, in tech stocks. Man, they're going to go up and up and up. And these are guys that live in West Bloomfield and Grosse Pointe. They're all telling me the same thing. Why do you have all this conservative investments? I mean, you know, they were pretty puny, and they still are. But I said, none of these companies have ever, you know, these tech companies, these stocks have ever made, these companies have ever made a profit. I said, it doesn't make any sense to me. It's just all air. And they go, no, it's going to go up and up and up. Well, it all crashed in 1999 or 2000, whenever it was. And, you know, a lot of them lost their shirts. So am I, what are they, irresponsible? Are they dumb? Am I smart? Maybe I should be like a Warren Buffett or something like that. I don't know. Hey, one of the things that, thank you for your call, by the way, Carrick. I was thinking, because there's some homes in my neighborhood that have been foreclosed on. People have left. The homes are empty now. One of the things is our neighbors get together and we mow their lawns. We make it look like people live there. In fact, some of these homes look better than they did when these folks lived in them. But if we're talking about a 1.2 million homes being foreclosed, where do the people go? In fact, got to be some of you out there. When you lose your home, I mean, I can't imagine that happening. I mean, what horrid emotional trauma that must be to lose your home. I mean, one thing, maybe if you bought it 3 years ago, but some of these people have lost their homes. They've been in there for 20, 25 years. Where do you go? Maybe if you're young, you go back with your parents or something like that. But, I mean, you just rent then? And, I mean, isn't this sending rent sky high, even though, you know, the home prices are dropping. One of the things that's happening, you know, there's homes, you can get homes 20, 25,000 in suburbs, you know, Ferndale, Oak Park, Royal Oak, what have you, and homes like in Huntington Woods for $130,000 and but you know what? The banks are not giving out many loans. You know why? Because they're worried about two things. One is that housing prices are going to drop even more. So say somebody buys this home that was $200,000 for $70,000, and they go, oh, well, gee, they can pay that back. Then suddenly the home's worth $50,000, and the home is underwater, and the person might walk away, and the bank's going to lose. Or with the economy still so unstable, who knows whether this person is going to have a job in 2 months and default on the loan. The bank is going to be stuck with yet another home. But I'm interested in any personal stories. When your home is foreclosed upon, where do you go? What do you do then? I mean, is everything just headed south? I mean, if you lived in a middle class neighborhood, do you go to a working class neighborhood? If you live in a working class neighborhood, do you go to a poorer neighborhood? If you're rich, do you go to a middle class neighborhood? 313-298-WRIF. That's our phone number. Here's Dave in Marysville. Dave, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Good.
You know, I was listening to you all the way up. I was driving up 94, and I was listening to you go on and on and on about the teabagger thing again.
Yeah.
What the hell is with the teabagger thing?
What's the what?
What's with the teabagger thing?
What do you mean?
I mean, listen, I'm a constitutional conservative.
Yeah.
And I've been to a number of tea parties that have to do with nothing but turning back where we've gone to with the socialist democratic lean back to being a constitutional conservative country.
You mean like under Bush?
What do you mean Bush? It had nothing to do with Bush.
Well, no. You said back to. Where would we go back to? I mean, what time? What period?
I consider myself a Reagan conservative.
Reagan. So Reagan, who expanded government, both the government debt and government spending enormously?
Well, not as much as Bill Clinton or Barack Obama.
Well, you know who really expanded was a guy named George W. Bush, right?
Well, no, Bill, yeah, listen, Bush was not perfect.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear you say that because share that.
As a conservative, I mean, since 2002 with what he did with the increases he put on government, I mean, you got to understand there's so many conservatives that were just so unhappy with George Bush. I mean, we weren't happy, but what did he have to offer? We had John Kerry. And John Edwards, and then we had, Barack Obama.
Well, we are talking again about, the choices that no one likes. I mean, the best, who should have ran, and they couldn't do it because the money wasn't there. Who should have been? I've said this 100 times. 2008, the race should have been between Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich. Hey?
Which would have been even better.
Well, no, those represent the authentic aspirations of different sectors of the American population. Both candidates would have opposed an American police state.
You actually love what Barack Obama's done in the last 2 years?
No, I've never, you know, I was never a big fan of Barack Obama. I just did not want essentially an affirmation of the preceding 8 years to occur. I mean, I'm stuck like everybody else. You know, you vote for the lesser of the two evil, you know, instead of the evil of the lesser.
Left and right. We're stuck with left and right, and neither one has anything to offer right now.
Well,
but,
okay.
But, I mean, but listen to me.
Yeah, go ahead.
But you knock on the Tea Party, and you say that, you know, you're looking for a different party, a different group of people to, you know, come together and find a candidate. And all your biggest thing is calling these people teabaggers.
Well, that's not my biggest thing.
You and I both know that it's a sexual reference. It's bull crap.
Well, wait a minute. That is what they initially referred to themselves as.
Not, and that's a lie. That's a flat out lie.
Okay, well,
Tea Party people call themselves teabaggers. I mean, come on.
They did. That's what it. You know, someone discovered. I never knew the sexual reference. Then it came out after they kept referring to themselves as teabaggers. Then then all of a sudden, boom, a little light bulb came out and some gay guys came on and said, hey, you know what this, really is all about? And then they go, oh, well, no, you know, teabaggers.
But still, it's offensive. And I mean, if you want to get your point across, why would you be offensive to half the people that listen to your show or half the people listening to the country?
Well, let's get this straight. First off, teabaggers, sorry, I'm going to keep calling them that because it's a talk show and it's not NPR. I doubt where there's anything like half the country. I think the last polls I saw, it was like 17%. And this nation is run on capitalism, and I have to do some business before midnight, so I will check into the thing about teabagger. Dave, thank you very much for calling, and we will be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
That's the sound of people throwing out their old dehumidifiers. They've replaced them with the energy-saving Wave Ventilation Unit. Wave Ventilation expels moisture, gases, and toxins trapped in your basement or crawl space and replaces it with drier, fresher air. The computerized Wave Ventilation requires no maintenance. There are no buckets to empty, no filters to change. And compared to a dehumidifier, it will save you hundreds of dollars a year in energy costs. One customer wrote,
I was stunned by the difference. I had a dehumidifier for almost 20 years without ever getting rid of that musty smell. And now that smell is finally gone.
Wave can transform your home into a drier, healthier environment. Satisfaction guaranteed. Find out more about Wave Ventilation right now.
For free information, go to goodairnow.com. That's goodairnow.com. Or call 1-866-324-9481. That's 1-866-324-9481.
Detroit's Rock Station, 101 WRIF.
The Ref.
These days, carrying a mortgage can overwhelm even the strongest person.
Don't I know that?
But there is a way to help ease your struggle, especially if you're facing foreclosure. One option may be advice from a certified foreclosure prevention specialist. It's absolutely free. Don't struggle. Learn more at www.makinghomeaffordable.gov. That's makinghomeaffordable.gov. Because foreclosure is not a foregone conclusion. A message from HUD in partnership with the National Fair Housing Alliance.
101 The Riff.
My name's Rachel, and I'm 10 years old. I like riding my bike, playing soccer, and in 8 years, I'll be an alcoholic. I'll start drinking in middle school, just at parties. My friends will drink, so I will too.
Kids who drink before age 15 are 5 times more likely to have alcohol problems when they're adults.
My parents won't really know what's going on yet. I mean, I'll do okay in school, but when I drink, I'll do some things I don't really want to do. So by the time my parents talk to me about it, alcohol won't be my only problem.
Alcohol affects their judgment and their future, so start talking before they start drinking.
My parents won't believe it could happen to me.
For more information on teens and alcohol, and to learn what you can do, visit the web at stopalcoholabuse.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Ad Council, and this station.
Yes. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome to our second hour. Jalene Jordan off with laryngitis. She was going to call in, but last I talked to her, she was talking like this. She probably has no voice now, but she is monitoring the Night Call Facebook page. You can go to facebook.com/nightcall. She will add you as a friend. You can knock all of these topics that we're talking about around with her. In an hour, we're going to be doing a couple of interviews. My memory's not working well, but I'll think of who's going to be on in a minute or so. Or you can go to Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, as I will. WERBE, PeterWerbe.com, and see who the guest is going to be. Let's see. Brian writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Hello, Peter. Angeline, if you're reading this, it's Brian from Windsor. Your caller made it obvious that the teabaggers don't realize that they are pawns in a bigger scheme where the only interest is in creating even more private power, and like the Republicans, give a false impression that anyone is capable of becoming one of the top 1% through some distorted version of the American dream. Thanks for another great show. Now, our last caller from Marshall, Michigan, said that this was an insult, an offensive insult to call them teabaggers, right? Now, here, let me see. This is at politicusa.com. On his MSNBC show, Countdown, host Keith Olbermann reminded the teabaggers, who just now seem to have figured out what the name means, I think this is from a while ago, where the term teabagger came from. Now, our last caller said it wasn't them. Hit, it wasn't Maddow or Olbermann, but the teabaggers themselves who coined the term. Olbermann said it's useful to remind them anew of how the term originated and with whom. A TV report aired last March 14th in which a correspondent described the original protest act as take a teabag, put it in an envelope, and mail it to the White House. He added, reteaparty.com as a headline, teabag the fools in D.C. on tax day. Thus, the verb to teabag was invented by the teabaggers themselves, and the correspondent who put it on TV was a Griff Jenkins of Fox News. He says, send your complaints to him. So that's it. They'll always be teabaggers to me. I can almost sing that. Huh? Hey, one of the things, hold on. Oh, this is one of the ways I get people to hold on. Jim and Roger and Mike and Aaron and Matt and Glenn. Hold on. I want to talk something about, our last caller was talking about being a constitutional conservative. I should have asked him about this. The Department of Justice says it intends to prosecute marijuana laws in California aggressively, even if state voters approve an initiative on November 2nd to legalize the drug. There's an initiative on the ballot that would legalize the weed for people in California. The announcement by the Attorney General Eric Holder was the latest reminder of how much of the establishment is lined up against the popular initiative. Dozens of editorial boards, candidates for office, Governor Schwarzenegger, and other public officials. Still, despite this opposition, or perhaps to some extent because of it, the measure, Prop 19, appears to have at least a decent chance of winning. That's going to win for sure. So far, drawing considerable support in polls from a coalition of Democrats, independents, younger voters, and men as election day nears. Republicans are going to vote against this. Should that happen, it would cement a cultural shift in California where medical marijuana has been legal since 1996, where the drug has been celebrated in popular culture, at least since the 1960s. It would also plunge the nation's most populous state into a murky and unsettling conflict with the federal government that opponents of the proposition said should make California voters wary of supporting it. And they said that it's one thing. They look the other way. For the medical marijuana industry, it's something else if it's made explicit by legalizing marijuana for recreational use, bring a whole new level of scrutiny from Washington. Well, most of us, I suspect, particularly RIF listeners, are going to say, what, man, this is just more repressive government stuff or repressive Obama stuff. You know, this is interesting. I was just outraged at the thought that the people of California would, say we want to be able to smoke marijuana the way that people drink alcohol. And, you know, the whole argument about that, the whole argument against marijuana has fallen apart so long ago, and it's just all another source for clients for the prison industrial complex. So we got to get rid of all these laws. But there is federal laws against marijuana. One thing, there's something called the Marijuana Stamp Tax Act. You have to have a, I suppose they could do that, right? They could apply for, you know, pay for a stamp tax. a stamp you get, and then you, it's okay to have it. But here's the deal. This gets back to the states' rights thing. What if Nebraska said, we're abolishing abortion? Well, they can't do that, you know, because there's a federal law that supersedes that. What if they said in, I don't know, Wisconsin, they're going to, that if you're a Muslim, you can't vote. That's our state, decided that. Right here, they're saying we can, if we want to smoke marijuana, we're going to get rid of the state laws. But there's a federal law against it. There's something there, I'll tell you. Okay, let's go to Glenn in Southgate. He's been waiting a long time. Glenn, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Glenn.
Hey, you were talking about earlier about foreclosed houses.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm 17, and a couple years back, I was living in Flat Rock. And the landlord, her house was already foreclosed, and, like, she had a lower flat and an upper flat, and we were staying in an upper flat, and we got there for, like, a month. And then she came upstairs, like, you know, at the end of that month and told us we had to get out because her husband, you know, kind of got back at her for something or whatever.
Yeah.
And then we had to move out, and we had literally nowhere to go.
That sucks.
And I had to sell my guitar and my amp and all sorts of stuff just so we can get a house.
Wow, and that one guy was saying, whoa, that's good. Foreclose on people, and that'll learn them.
Yeah, that guy is crazy.
Well, sort of low, what we call low on the compassion scale.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's one of the things of the people on the right. They're always big on punishing the average person. And although they express a lot of anger against the big shots, the banksters and, you know, the rest of the elite, that's really who's financing their movement. And that's who really stands to gain the most. I don't get them. I mean, I could actually understand if they started some third party, and there are some, you know, right-wing third parties. But the fact that they are supporting part of the elite establishment, and one of the elite establishment parties, Democrats qualify as that as well, not as bad as the Republicans, but still. So I don't get them. I mean, it just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. All right, Glenn, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here, oh, man, some of you have been waiting so long. Jim, Lincoln Park, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Peter. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Okay, I'm sorry. I've been waiting in on traffic here. I turned on your show, and I'm a factory worker down here in lower Michigan here, and I noticed you were alluding to the way people voted, and in the last couple elections, the way I've seen it is it's mostly working class people are voting, and from my perspective, it seems that people are just voting the way they think that's going to affect their family. Like me, for instance, I have five children, and a candidate, say Bush, for instance. I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. Bush, for instance.
Yeah.
When Clinton was in office, he brought about this NAFTA, which affected us in a really poorly way, us factory workers.
Absolutely.
And then when Bush got in office, he enacted this steel tariffs, which in my job, it affected me greatly. It kept me making money, kept me working. And to me, that was a positive thing. And that's how I looked at it, was this candidate was, or this president was positive at the time because he kept food on my table. And every time there's a candidate in that affects my family in a positive way, and I think it's most people in general, they're going to stick with that candidate or they're going to stick with that party. From what I've seen, since I've been working, the Democrats don't seem like they want to keep us working. It seems like the Republicans do.
How do you figure? How do you figure that? What are they going to do? What have the Democrats done wrong? What are the Republicans? I mean, I don't.
Well, I gave you two examples. So.
I see what you're saying. This, by the way, the majority, all the Republicans voted for NAFTA. the so-called North American Free Trade Act, that is one of the things that's drained jobs from the United States. All the Republicans voted for that. The majority of Democrats voted against it. And the Democratic Party, the Democratic president, as you said, Bill Clinton, the dismay of a lot of people, signed it. I mean, he should have vetoed it, but he's a corporate Democrat, to be sure, Bill Clinton. But I got to tell you, the majority of Democrats in the Senate and in the House voted against NAFTA, without a doubt.
No, I understand that. I do understand that. But as you said, he could have vetoed this. And it just seems to me that Democrats have had a very negative effect on the working man, just from what I've seen in my working life.
Well, yeah, and so have the Republicans. And by extending these tax breaks to the wealthy, they're responsible for killing thousands of working class people through the war in Iraq, our soldiers, and creating this enormous deficit that you and your kids and your grandchildren are going to still be paying for, even if things get back on the right track. So, I mean, I always get put in the position of defending the Democrats, which I don't mean to in any forceful way. But the Republicans are certainly nothing that I can understand an ordinary person supporting. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Oh, here's somebody from Ann Arbor. It's Mike, who's been waiting a long time on hold as well. Mike, hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, I appreciate it. First of all, I got to say, I agree they are teabaggers.
Well, okay.
I mean, I don't agree with anything that they have to say. They're just crazy. They run amok for nothing. Secondly, when it comes to people that are mad about President Obama and the Democrats right now, if they've been paying attention to the news, anytime the Democrats try to do something, they're all shut down by the Republicans, the good old party. I mean, people need to pay attention to that. Just my last point would be, you can't expect anything to change within 4 years when it took 8 years to break it. It's going to be a long time for us to rebuild and get the U.S. back to where we were, financially and stable, and stability-wise.
You know, Mike, what I'm afraid of, and some people have said this, that we're never going to get back to where we were. And people have put forth what I've just called, I mean, this is my formulation, but other people have talked about this process, calling it the Guatemala model. That is to say, we'll wind up with a third of the population being well-waged, that all of wealth and capital will circulate, or the vast majority of it, within that upper third. So we'll still have people living in these big houses and driving big cars and all that. But two-thirds of us are going to wind up, being peasants or peons.
Right.
Well, don't say right. You scare me.
No, I'm just saying it's just a bad situation. But, I mean, we'll recover. We are Americans. We always do. But people just have to be patient with it. It's not going to be, if anything, if they were to do anything expedient right now, it's just going to be a Band-Aid. I mean, we just have to really just restructure everything.
Yeah. Well, no, that is key, restructuring. One thing we got to restructure is the taxes. We got to have enormous taxes on the wealthy, not this little teeny bit that Obama wants to restore. Again, that's the only thing he could probably do. Can you imagine that? We're talking about taking the tax rate on the upper 1% to the level that it was during the Bush administration. Or when Bush came in. Well, I mean, they're not talking about, eating the rich or anything like that. I mean, there should be over $2-3 million. It ought to be like 90% tax on that. I mean, because we're in a bad way now. And that money ought to be recycled through the government in the manner that the war budget does. Right now, we're taking from all of us almost $700 billion a year. That's what the so-called defense budget is. And there's really another $300 billion in there as well that is really about war. So we're spending $1 trillion a year, taking it from the population and giving it out to contractors and war corporations and defense contractors and what have you. If you took one half of that and had a real stimulus program, because that's what the war budget is. It's exactly, it's socialism. It is government-funded work. except this way. If we started rebuilding our infrastructure, if we had good schools with low numbers of classes, can you imagine that we actually have failing schools in the richest country in the world? That's insane. And it's all because of the priorities that, as you said, Mike, need to be restructured. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here is Matt in Richmond. Hey, Matt. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Hi.
How you doing, Peter?
Good.
Yeah, just a lot of people I can see right now. I mean, it's nothing to anybody else, but, you know, I'm a vet myself from, you know, from the war and whatnot. I'm only 22 years old. I mean, I've seen a lot of stuff come and go, and just the way this country is falling, it's slowly decreasing. You know, just the way a lot of these people, you know, just think, and they think, oh, you know, we're doing so great, you know, and what we're doing right now, we're mainly focusing more on stuff that's going on overseas and not what we're supposed to be doing with ourselves right now. We're supposed to be trying to fix ourselves, and we're getting into every other, you know, aspects of, you know, other people's countries. And
there you go. Yeah, if you were a vet, you saw it.
Yeah, exactly my point, you know, but, you know, what I don't see is, you know, I wish, you know, some people would open their eyes and what you're talking about, how the state of California is passing the Marijuana Act. It's legal to smoke pot in California now.
No, it's up for a vote on November 2nd.
It is?
Yeah. I mean, you can have medical marijuana, so a lot of people are smoking for their medical conditions, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And for medical conditions, but I've seen a lot of people who are using it for not the purpose that they're supposed to be doing and just think it's cool to get, you know, get high and whatnot. Just
Matt, I'm shocked. I can't imagine that. There's actually people that are misusing this medical marijuana law? Man.
Exactly. And, you know, I've noticed a couple different changes, especially on the streets these days. You know, before the war in Iraq even started, you know, I've seen a lot of people, you know, come to different types of drugs, like drugs now, such as, you know, heroin is being put on the street now more.
Really?
It's pretty much being a common drug just like marijuana is.
Wow, I thought we were way beyond that. What do I know, though? Huh?
Yeah, I mean, marijuana and heroin, I mean, there's similarities between it, but heroin was never really common. It was really hard to find on the streets at one point or another before this war started. A lot of it we've been getting due to the whole war industry and everything else. People are smuggling it back into the country from other different countries around the world. Not a lot of people see it, but, you know, and people aren't even questioning, you know, what's going on here. You know, it's, you know, we have so many different types of races, people everywhere in this country, and, you know, it's.
Well,
you know,
here is what. I mean, what I hear, and I mean, I feel identical. There are so many things going wrong on so many fronts that it almost defies the imagination that there's political will in one direction that can fix it all. And having expectations that somebody can may be unrealistic. But like I say, I mean, I had one suggestion that all this money that essentially is being, you know, taken from us as taxes and then used for these wars all over the world could be used, I think, a lot more constructively here at home, as you're saying. All right, thank you very much, Matt, and welcome back. Glad you got back in, you know, one piece. Thank you. And let's see, here is Aaron. Aaron's in Milford. Hi, Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, why would you think I couldn't?
Well, sometimes people have a problem hearing me. I got this new phone, and it kind of sucks.
Okay. One of the clearer voices. Go ahead, you got to. Working. Go ahead.
Okay, cool. Well, earlier when I first started listening to the show tonight, there was this guy, I think his name was Ron, he was like totally screaming at you because you guys were like debating about, you know, the Tea Party and the Republicans being like morons and stuff, you know.
Idiots.
Well, I'm nervous. I'm not going to sound all that smart right now, so forgive me. But anyways, he should have realized that he lost the argument when he had to start like screaming at you over something semi-trivial or something that we already, you know, they're idiots and they don't really understand the issue. And, you know, that other guy arguing with you about the tea partiers never calling themselves teabaggers in the first place, that just shows you how much these people understand the issues. They're just angry semi-insane people as far as I'm concerned.
Well, they are angry. And you know what I said, actually, Aaron, at the beginning of the show, and you may have heard, is I said, in many ways, these are the people that have the least to be angry with. I mean, they're upper middle class, a lot of them.
And they're about to retire and collect Social Security and stuff. You know, they're
wait a minute. Isn't that socialism? Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, we were just debating that at my friend's house before I left. That's when I started listening to the show tonight, was when I left and came home and stuff. And, you know, we were just debating that, like, maybe 15 minutes before I left. And I don't know, maybe it's, like, cosmic or something.
Well, it could be. Yeah, and it's sort of odd when you see these. I mean, I remember reading articles saying, you know, so-and-so, 72, a retiree, says that he hates the socialist direction this country is going in. I'm thinking 72, which means he's a good part of his income is coming from Social Security, and all of his medical stuff is being taken care of by Medicare, both of which were opposed by the Republicans in 1965 for the medical, and what was it, 1933 or 34, or whenever, maybe it was the late 30s, for Social Security. And again, the Republicans said, this is socialism, and the whole country is going to go down the drain if we don't do this and all that. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate you listening and calling. By the way, all right, never mind. I'm loving the call, so I'll keep going on. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Here is Roger in Detroit. Roger, hi. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
Sounds like you're earning your check.
Well, hey, I love it. I love it.
I just wanted to say, I've been listening to a lot of things on this radio, especially the teabaggers. What you said about the marijuana thing in California, I didn't know that, but it sounds to me like things are being, they're trying to ratify it through state. I think it's a states' rights thing, really. But that's rather beside the point. What I really wanted to say is,
Let me stop you. It is. So what do states have rights to?
Well, they've been doing that for about the past 100 years. Every time something controversial comes up, they can be decided by the federal government, they come in and, you know, make a big deal about it. And I think that's what it had a lot. They want to maintain their control in the state, and that's how they do things. They did the same thing with civil rights. It's all the same difference.
Sure, exactly.
And what I should say is that democracy ended with Reconstruction, and they invented the caste system, which is what we've had for about the past 70 years. And once that's gone, they're going back to what they had in Europe, which is the feudal state. Because the middle class, this never really existed as a real thing. It's all about money and class and stuff. And I'm not much into political science, but I do know history.
Well, you're right. You're right.
Right. And that's why I like listening to you, because at least you know your history. Because most people don't study that anymore, but it's really important, because that was a lot of historians and German historians that tried to show that if people don't learn anything from the past, they'll keep on repeating, and that's what they've been doing. And all this country has been is about acquisition of land, money, power, and it's still about that. It's not about being fair or democracy. It's all about, like, the marijuana. I mean, it's no morality. It's very much about how much money can be made off of it. And until they can find a way to make money out of it to where they can get money in their pockets, they're not going to legalize it. There's no morality in it. It's not against God. It's against them. They're making the rules.
You got it. All right. Thank you. And, yeah, I always keep thinking, if you haven't already seen George Carlin's little clip, it's all over the Internet on YouTube, they own you. It's a, you know, it's, I would play it, except I would have to clip out almost every other word. All righty, let's continue onward. Here's Frederick in Dearborn. Frederick, hi, you're on the air.
Peter.
No, you're good. You're going to talk to me right through your phone, I hope.
I had you on speaker for a second.
Okay. Wow, you scared me. Good. Go ahead.
What do you think would happen if the Republicans do win and take control of the House and Senate?
Well, you know, I don't know, because here's what they say. They would introduce, every single week, they would introduce bills that would cut spending. Well, what are they? They don't even say what. They wouldn't have any more TARP payments, you know, the troubled asset, what was that? I forgot, TARP, whatever. In other words, these bailouts. Well, those are kind of over anyway. So they don't say what would they cut. What would they cut? Money for schools, for the infrastructure, Medicare?
Would you mind if I rephrase the question?
No. Go ahead. No. Do you? I don't know. Do you know?
What? No. I don't. What do you think as far as Obama? How much control would he have?
Well, he would do in those cases where there is a Congress, the way Bush did in his final years, just kind of sat around, no legislation got passed. Right. So we'd really be screwed. We'd be totally screwed because government would be paralyzed. Obama hopefully wouldn't sign off on sign bills that the Republicans passed. I have no idea what they intend. One of the things they want to do, of course, is they want to extend the tax breaks to their rich buddies, the upper 1%, and that would cost $700 billion. So we'd be worse off. I'm not sure what they would do.
I mean, here's my question.
Sure.
When Bush was in there and the Democrats had control, the housing market just took a dump.
Yeah.
So how can you blame it on Bush, though?
Well, it was policies that it was this, actually what it is. You got to go way back to Reaganomics. That Reagan, who did not, who thought that there should be a lack of regulation in almost every sphere, and that would create that's what they call the supply side economics, that it would increase investment. Rather, what it did was create increasing, speculative investments. And one of the worst, three worst things that Clinton signed on, all Republican backed, the majority of Democrats voted against it. So, practical purposes, Clinton might as well have been a Republican, where what the one caller said was the NAFTA bill. Then there was the telecommunications law, which allowed this concentration of media. And then the other thing was that the Republicans wanted was this bill that was passed during the Depression that was called the Glass-Steagall bill. And that forbid banks from becoming these investment firms. And that just let everything fly loose. And if you want to say it's the Democrats and the Republicans, I would certainly I wouldn't start arguing with you. But it was most of this stuff is driven by the Republicans, and there's enough Democrats that are close enough to these conservative Republicans that I don't know what you'd say. They're not worthy of the name, or they disgrace the name of the Democrats, or that's actually who they are. I mean, you got to remember, the Democrats have some pretty ugly history as well. If you think about all these Southern racist segregationist senators and representatives, they were some of the worst segregationists and right-wingers and what have you. I mean, they're really, let me say this. People on the left have been saying for probably 70 years that there's got to be some realignment of the parties. Get all the damn conservatives in one party and let the people that represent the real left that want to, that have specific programs other than just giving it all to the corporations, put forth programs that aren't going to be shot down at every step of the way. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Let's see here. I don't know. We're not. Okay. There we go. I see why I couldn't get rid of the call. Right, got some more calls here. 313-298-WRF. I wanted to say one thing. So what would this all mean? One of the things we keep talking about. California's construction industry came crashing to earth when the housing bubble burst. Ever since, union leaders and non-union contractors have fought hammer and tongs. Wow. For a bigger share of the shrunken business, much of which is in the public sector. Labor unions have used their clout to persuade many city councils, county boards, and school districts to adopt policies that favor unionized contractors and workers for building projects like schools and prisons. Fuming at the favoritism, non-union contractors have begun turning to the ballot box. And so what they're doing, they're talking about they're getting all these initiatives that would stop this preferential hiring for unions. And so the head of the Coalition for Fair Employment and Construction, a business-backed group promoting this countywide ban, said this isn't a union or non-union issue. This is a fairness or discrimination issue. What this is really about is twofold. One, it's a further lowering of the wage. Private unionization, you'd think the businesses wouldn't even care about that because union members in the private sector are now down to 7%. Right, so 93% of workers in the private sector aren't even unionized. So you'd say, who cares, right? Well, they do care. Because in, for instance, the construction union, They don't want to have to pay people construction union wages. They want to pay what the market will bear. And in some places, people are always screaming about immigrants doing drywall hanging and all that. Well, that's where it's all going. I mean, that's what happened when you, for instance, in the Meatpackers Union, which was a high paid, I mean, there was a lot of problems. I mean, we want to go into the whole thing, but it's not without problems. But the Meat Cutters Union was a strong, powerful union that had high wages, good benefits for its workers. It's now almost exclusively immigrant labor, and they're paying people like $8 an hour, right? Starvation wages, poverty wages, and what have you. And so this drives everything further down and down. Then when you look at union wages, people getting $24, $25 an hour. This is their life, by the way. This is anyone who's at work 8 hours a day. This is the majority of your life. And you deserve to get paid well as an industry can pay. But if you're on the other side of things, what you want to pay is as low as possible, because the less you pay, the more you make. So it's all about distribution of wealth and income. And whose side are you on? Are you on the guy's side that want to lower everybody's wages? And believe me, they want to lower everybody's wages. The unions, throughout for the last 120 years or so, have led the struggle to raise everyone's wages. And even, well, first off, many of them were very, very, what would you say, articulate about this, that they're leading the, just like Bob King, the new president of the UAW says, picking up the mantle of Walter Reuther, one of the founders of the UAW. He says, we are a social movement. We speak on behalf of all workers, whether you're blue collar or white collar, because they represent white collar workers as well. And it doesn't matter whether you're in the UAW or not, because Bob King understands that, and you might not. You might think, why do they deserve $25 an hour like that? The old party of resentment. I'm only making $9 an hour. Well, when auto workers start making $14 an hour, like this mistaken policy that the UAW agreed to, so they're going to start having two-tier wages and people making $14 an hour, suddenly $9 an hour isn't so bad. But what you should be looking at, wait a minute, if corporations can afford to pay $25 an hour, and they can, they just need to have less return on their investment for their stockholders, the people that own but do no work. In fact, it's not even directly related. It's how the stock is being sold in that great crap game in the sky. So there's an old song about the union struggles in Harlan County, Kentucky. Which side are you on? And what happens? Teabaggers and all that, they're on the side of the bosses. They're on the side of the ultra-rich. They're on the side of the corporations. And, you know, they say, no, we're not. We don't want socialism and all that. But whatever they want, whatever they think they're doing, that ain't what they're doing. They are supporting the people that are driving wages down, driving the standard of living down, driving our benefits down, driving our pensions down. And when they start talking about getting rid of the minimum wage, you know, like some of these teabag candidates wanted, what do you think that means? That means that you get rid of the minimum wage and let the market take over, the free market. What that means is they want you to work for $3 an hour. That's what it means. They want you to work for $3 an hour. And who does that benefit? Does it benefit the economy, or does it benefit the people who they are the stooges for? Or they want to get Republican politicians in there that'll get rid of all the environmental controls on what the Koch brothers own. And, so that all of us can suck bad air. Be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Time's running out. You're maxed out on your credit cards. The collection calls are coming every day. And now you're two payments behind on your mortgage. Every time you turn on the radio, there's some cheerful couple telling you how they got out of debt overnight. Their stress is gone, and everything's just wonderful. Come on. The truth is, what sounds too good to be true is too good to be true. You need real help, and you need it now. Not bankruptcy. That should be your last choice. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're the attorney-driven program, dedicated to helping you get out of debt in months instead of years, saving you thousands, and without risking your family home. We know what we're doing, and we don't make promises we can't keep. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Get out of debt. Call Credit Card Relief at 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282. If you want a new computer but think you can't get credit, think again. Just call Tronics Country right now. No matter what your credit status is, now you can own a brand new desktop or laptop computer. Your approval is guaranteed as long as you have an active checking account and can afford small weekly payments. With Tronics Country, there's no credit check. You will not be turned down. Call right now and order your new computer. You'll also get a free color printer and a free digital camera. Just call 800-990-2258. But that's not all. Call right now and you'll also get a free 22-inch high-definition TV with your paid purchase. You heard right. A free TV with your new computer. All you need is an active checking account and your approval is guaranteed. Don't wait. Call Tronics Country right now. Call 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents lime scale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Jalene is off for the night. She has laryngitis. She was going to call in. I think her voice is probably so bad by now. Jalene, if you're still up, give me an email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. The rest of you can do the same. By the way, she is, I was just looking at our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/nightcall. Pardon me. And what we're doing is adding people to our Facebook page. You can comment on what I've been saying and the callers have been saying. And Jalene says, I will personally add them, as well as I will comment on a few things during the show. I don't know. I mean, I'm not logged in. So also, there's a brand new photograph of Jalene and me. She looks terrific. I look okay. Imagine that. You know, you see a group of 10 people, and you go, you look at the, and first you look at it is yourself. I don't know. Or maybe it's just me doing that. But anyway, Chris and Debbie, I see, have commented on the Facebook page. And also, under the people that like this, hello, Ed, and hello, Don. I say hello to both of them because those are two people I know. All right. At 1 a.m., this was, let me get you this first. Who's this here? I'm losing. Oh, Jonathan writes in. I was talking about in California how the feds have said they are going to step up their enforcement of federal anti-marijuana laws if California legalizes it. And I said, well, first I was outraged. Pardon me. But then I was thinking, that's a whole state's right things. And what if Nebraska said, well, we're outlawing abortion. And Wisconsin said, we're not going to allow Muslims to vote. So here's what Jonathan says. In regard to California marijuana federal and state laws, I think your possible examples of other states doesn't compare to California. Your examples take away people's rights. California expands rights. I think that should be the distinction, whether the federal government should pursue legal action. Does the state law expand or deny rights? Well, I guess that sounds good. I like the way that sounds, Jonathan. But, in terms of constitutional law, I don't think it goes down like that, right? Mike from Troy writes, anyone who could sit there and defend Democrats and blame Republicans for the massive debt our country is experiencing has their head in the sand. $3 trillion in the last 3 years. Bush looked like a penny pincher compared to what we now have. Both parties use smoke and mirrors, economic figuring. That's true. Wake up and realize we need an honest, limited government party. The two-party system needs to go. Thankfully, guys like you are in the minority, been listening for 20-plus years. And I'm definitely blue-collar. Well, as long as you're not... Anybody that's blue-collar and supporting the Republicans really needs to have their head examined. So, but you want to blame the Democrats and the Republicans? I'm perfectly okay with that. I just say until there is some movement, and I don't think we need smaller government. I think we need a bigger government that has different priorities, that protects people against the rapacious assault on our standard of living by the corporations and the banksters. That's for sure. That we need incredible regulation and control over the financial industries, over corporations, the power they have in elections, and over the environment. You can't have small government and do that. Right? We have massive government now. It's mostly a military-industrial complex. You want that to go like Ron Paul does? Get rid of the 700 overseas bases? I'm all there with you. But I appreciate you listening for so long, Mike, and to writing in as well. Okay, let's get some calls down because we're in our last segment. Oh, yeah, at 1 a.m., it is Danielle McGuire, a prof at Wayne State University. She's written an unusual book about Rosa Parks. You go, Rosa Parks, I know all about that civil rights thing. This is pretty unusual stuff. Let's see, here is Ben in Rochester. Ben, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good.
You were arguing a point with a caller earlier about how Social Security wasn't going broke.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get your thoughts on if they're not going broke, then why is this the only year that there hasn't been an adjustment for increased cost of living, and you're still a douchebag.
Okay. Oh, maybe I'll get rid of that, just for the hell of it. I don't know. Never know how much of this comes over the air. He was saying that why, if the Social Security system isn't going broke, was there not a cost of living increase? Well, hello, there's the inflation is so low. So low, there's no cost of living. But I don't know what happened to that. I looked that up during the break about Social Security going broke. The government has been borrowing from the Social Security fund, so it's owed like $1 trillion by the government. I mean, something's got to be done. And one of the things, I don't know, Mike, write back. If you're still listening, Mike from Troy, who said that this large debt has been run up. We have to run up this huge debt. I mean, it's like wartime when we run up this huge debt. If there is not this enormous government stimulus, which there's nowhere near enough, we're really going to go down the tubes, or we're just going to have this massive unemployment forever, and we're going to be like Mexico or Guatemala or something like that. Right now, there's $1 trillion a year being spent in preparation for war, all these bases and all, and we get very, very, we get a much smaller bang for our buck than we would if that was directly put into the kind of programs, the stimulus that happened under the Roosevelt administration. Roosevelt then cut back on it under pressure, and we went into another recession in 1938. So what do you think about that, Mike? All right, let's go back to our phones, and here is Kevin. Kevin's in Westland. Kevin, thanks for joining us here on the air.
Hey, thanks, Peter. Hey, you guys were talking earlier about these foreclosures.
Right.
And the problems that we're facing with this. I am an auto worker, and thank you for explaining the union wages to people, because I don't even really tell people I'm an auto worker because I'm tired of hearing that stuff. But I'm watching my neighbors walk away from houses. Left and right. These are people that can afford them. They're getting away with it, so they're doing it.
I mean, they're underwater and they don't want to. I don't get it.
Yeah, they're backward. They're upside down on their mortgage, and they can afford to stay and pay their bills, but they just choose to walk away from them.
Why do they do that? It doesn't make a bit of economic sense.
I'm paying my bills. I'm watching people, and they're doing it all around me. Couple houses down, they just quit paying their mortgage. The banks come after them and ended up cutting their mortgage in half. Basically, they went from paying $1,400 a month to paying $350 a month, and they laugh about it. They think it's great. They got away with it.
Huh. Well,
what does that say to people like me that are paying my bills and I'm still behind, but I'm still paying my bills?
Well, most of the people that I know that have gone into foreclosure, have lost their jobs and or their houses. I mean, there's somebody near me. Let me see. So, yeah, it's less. The house is worth less than half. But it strikes me, and most of the advice that people have, I mean, that's what I'm saying. It doesn't seem to make a bit of sense on the face of it. Because say you're you bought a house in Westland for $175,000, worth $125,000 now, and you're paying, I don't know, $1,500 a month or something like that. Well, if you're going to live there for and you can afford it, if you're going to live there any appreciable amount of time, you know, what? You're going to ruin your credit. You're going to have that blotch on your record. And hopefully the prices will come back. But even if you don't, you keep paying for it. It's better. What are you going to do? Go rent? I don't know. I don't get it. I don't get why anybody would do that. All right. Thank you for that, though. Let's see. Here is Nick is in Rochester Hills. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going good.
All right. I was reading a recent alternate article that pointed out that the richest people in our country make upward of $2 billion a year, which is the equivalent of about $1 million a year. I mean, how on earth does somebody produce $1 million worth of goods and services in a single hour? So while the vast majority of working people earn near sustenance-level wages, what teabaggers need to do is demand higher wages. And if they want to revolt against something, don't blindly revolt against your government as a whole. Revolt against the super-rich and the politicians who represent them. And it just so happens that the Republicans and those unabetting teabagger candidates are the ones pushing the economic policies that perpetuate this massive disparity in wealth between working people and the super rich.
Well, Nick, I don't even know what exactly they want. They say they want to abolish or repeal. That's the word. They want to repeal the health care bill. Okay, it's got a lot of problems. It would have been a lot better if there would have been a public option. It would have been a lot better if it would have been a single-payer universal health care. That would have solved so many problems. But other than that, I'm not sure what they want. I mean, we know what their masters want, the rich corporate owners and the financiers that are putting all this money into the teabagger candidates. But it's not clear to me and why they launched with this rage that came out of nowhere. Well, it's like I said, you know, they've been described as the crazed hordes of the middle class. They're the ones that are probably suffering less than a lot of other people.
I don't know if I actually agree with that, because there's this other study out right now that says as people become more poor, they actually become more conservative, more likely to support smaller government, and actually perpetuate income inequality. So,
well, you know what? Then it becomes what Bruno Bettelheim called, or he designated as concentration camp behavior, or maybe even bring it up to more modern times, the Stockholm Syndrome. Remember that, where people that were hostages of kidnappers, they would begin to identify with their captors because they become so utterly powerless that they begin to identify with their masters. That's the only thing that I could imagine. Same thing in concentration camps occurred, as that Bettelheim realized. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here is Greg and Wayne. Greg, hi, you're on the air. Hey, Greg, did I not do it? Sorry, let me push the magic button. Greg, now you are on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, Peter, how are you doing today?
Doing good. Thanks for calling.
The reason I'm calling, I currently rent a house. And then all of a sudden, I get a notice on my door that my property is owned by Fannie Mae.
Huh.
And I have 14 days to evacuate.
Okay.
And I'm clueless as to what my rights are in this situation.
What did you say? You left it, though?
No, I'm renting a house.
Oh, you're renting
it. My landlord was not paying the mortgage.
Okay. Oh, so he is being foreclosed on, and they want the occupants to not evacuate. What's the word all of a sudden?
Evict.
Evict. Evicted. Thank you. I don't know. Actually, that's interesting. Actually, I don't know if you heard a little earlier. Some caller said that the same thing had happened to him. You know, the owner had screwed up.
Yeah, that's basically what happened to me. He's taking my money instead of paying the mortgage. He's putting it in his pocket until the bank came and foreclosed on him. And now I'm here with a disabled fiance who fell down the stairs, broke her ankle, and broke her heel, and dislodged her Achilles tendon. And I have 14 days to find a place and get out of here.
I suspect nothing's going to happen to you immediately. And I wonder what's happened. You know, these foreclosures seem to be on hold. I don't know if that affects these. I wonder why Fannie Mae is in it like that.
But that's what came on the paper on my desk.
Yeah.
It had a name of a realtor, and I called him, and he's like, well, you got 14 days, and you'll get $1,300 to move out. You have a month, you'll get $900 to move out. And then after a month, we file court proceedings for your eviction.
Huh. Well, I'm really even at a loss. Do you use the Internet?
Yeah.
You know what? Email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I'll see if I can think of somewhere. In the meantime, we don't have hardly any time left. The other people can call in. Lines are kind of loaded. But shoot me an email, and I'll see if I can figure out if there's anywhere I can suggest you go to, okay?
All right, I appreciate that.
All right, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Emails as well. Man, why are we facing this? I mean, people don't deserve this. And here's another case. Stock market's above 11,000. The richy rich kids are just, having a grand time. And folks like that, what did they do? Paid their rent? Remember, some people are, saying, some people are just walking away and all that. They didn't walk away. He's paying his rent. Probably, working man. And, okay, let's go on here, and here is Brad and Romulus. Brad, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Doing good. What's up?
Well, we got foreclosed on a year or so ago, and, you had said earlier about, where do these people go? Well, we kind of got forced into the trailer parks.
Yeah.
And what apparently had happened is after our dad passed away, before my dad passed away, he had signed a thing with TCF Bank saying that if something happens to mom or to dad, that the bank will promise to pay off the house. Well, TCF didn't hold up to their end of the bargain.
Nice.
They basically breached the contract. They canceled the insurance on us without notifying us, which was wrong. I mean, we lost our home. Mom kind of got mad about it, and she's like, I'm not going to make my mortgage payment now because they didn't pay off my house. So was mom wrong? Yes. Was TCF wrong? Absolutely. So, where did the people go? To the trailer parks, yeah. I guess.
I'll tell you,
where we were kind of forced.
I'll tell you, Brad, this sounds increasingly like the 1930s. It's really a shame. Sorry to hear about that, but thank you for telling us about it. Let's see. Here is Greg in Roseville. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Doing good.
I just want to make a couple comments. A lot of people are talking about me. And right now I live in Roseville, Michigan. I have nothing. But I worked for the unions back in 79, 80, TRW down in Sterling Heights. And they told me to work less and not work hard. They didn't want me to work over 2 hours a day for an eight-hour job. And what that tells me is they're wanting me to get paid mega bucks and not work.
Who's they?
Well, evidently UAW.
That's pretty.
Because UAW ran TRW. That's their union.
That's kind of unusual because they're all that stuff is covered by minute description of of job description and what has to be done and all that, and the UAW, I don't know if it was back then. I can't imagine that came down from from Owen Bieber or something like that, but if that was happening, that was wrong, to be sure. All right, let's see, here's Ted in Sterling Heights. Hey, Ted, you're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Peter.
Yeah, hi.
Question,
Mr. Ted.
This 1% this tax on transactions, did you ever hear about that? Because I got an email that basically that the government, or I don't know who, the Republicans, the Democrats, are supposed to have this 1% tax increase on transactions in the bank. So if you deposit money, 1% of that. If you withdraw any money, 1% of that. Did you hear anything about that?
There has been a call for that could be one way to raise funds. And I don't, not on, you know, not on you and me going to the store. I mean, that's just, that would be like a sales tax or something like that. But which right. is a, you know, what do they call it? Always at the end of the show, my brain begins to, anyway, let me say what they're really talking about. That the 1% fee on would be on stock transactions.
Stock transactions.
Yeah,
okay.
So that would raise like an enormous amount of money. I mean, these people are just, you know, these stock transactions that go like every 40 seconds. Some of these stock transactions they make like a penny on, but they're doing $1 billion a week or something like that.
So it's got nothing to do with like a check being cashed from work or anything?
Well, not what I've heard. I mean, certainly we, the people, the ordinary people, don't need any more taxes on us at all. If there's going to be any tax increases, which I think there should be, it should be on the upper 5%. Not even people, you know, this idea that people that are making $250,000 a year, which puts them in the 95th percentile of income, I think they would get an increase of, you know, in the hundreds of dollars if we got rid of the Bush tax breaks for the rich. But what we really have to go after are these people that have the capacity to take their own fortunes and buy political seats. I mean, this woman in Connecticut who used to run the Wrestling Federation, she's spending like $120 million to get the Senate seat in Connecticut. I mean, if there was a decent tax structure, she wouldn't be able to do it. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. And let's see. Here's Paul in Sterling Heights. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
Okay. You got no problem calling a teabagger a teabagger. I blog extensively.
Okay.
I do not claim any party affiliation, but I consider myself a working class liberal. Why don't you do what I do?
What's that?
Which is, if I'm blogging, if I'm debating a conservative, I just call them cheap labor conservatives.
Cheap,
I mean, that's
cheap
really
labor.
What they're all about,
right.
Isn't it?
Right. I want to say that real clearly, Paul. Cheap labor conservatives, because essentially what they want to do. I mean, I don't think the average teabagger is sitting around and thinking, I want me and my family and my neighbors to get paid less, but they're so stupid. They don't realize that they're cannon fodder for the wealthy elite that is trying to do exactly that. All right. Thanks for being our last caller, Paul. I appreciate it. Jalene Jordan here. It says Jalene fell asleep, but is now on Facebook. She's probably wondering, what happened to all... Everybody's wondering, wait a minute, I thought she was going to add me as a friend. So you can go to facebook.com/nightcall and get it. Here, one final thing. Lou Dobbs, this teabagger, he's a big teabag fan. He was getting 800,000 viewers, reported $6 million a year for his angry rants against illegal aliens. But guess what? It turns out he hires all these illegal. Oh, he was also against the employers. Well, it turns out Dobbs is casting stones from a house, make that an estate of glass, based on a year-long investigation by The Nation magazine. And you can go to, I don't know whether it's The Nation or just nation.com. I think it's The Nation. And where is this here? Real quickly, because we got to go. That Father Dobb has relied for years on undocumented labor for the upkeep of his multi-million-dollar estates and the horses he keeps for his 22-year-old daughter, Hillary. Dobbs lives in a sprawling white mansion on his 300-acre estate in Sussex, New Jersey, where he and his family run a horse farm. And he acquired another house, a spacious multi-million-dollar winter holiday home in Eagle Isle, wherever that is, the most exclusive enclave of the Ibis Golf and Country Club, a gated community in West Palm Beach, Florida. That's your heroes, folks. Eat the rich.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
All day today on 101 WRIF. Listen to score your free Riff tickets for the Pistons home opener against the Thunder Friday, October 29th. We're blowing out your Pistons home opener tickets every hour till midnight. Pistons home opener Monday. Listen and win from your Detroit Pistons and 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. That's the sound of people throwing out their old dehumidifiers. They've replaced them with the energy-saving Wave Ventilation Unit. Wave Ventilation expels moisture, gases, and toxins trapped in your basement or crawl space and replaces it with drier, fresher air. The computerized Wave Ventilation requires no maintenance. There are no buckets to empty, no filters to change. And compared to a dehumidifier, it will save you hundreds of dollars a year in energy costs. One customer wrote,
I was stunned by the difference. I had a dehumidifier for almost 20 years without ever getting rid of that musty smell. And now that smell is finally gone.
Wave can transform your home into a drier, healthier environment. Satisfaction guaranteed. Find out more about Wave Ventilation right now. For free information, go to goodairnow.com. That's goodairnow.com. Or call 1-866-324-9481. That's 1-866-324-9481. All day Monday on 101 WRIF. Listen to score your free Riff tickets for the Pistons home opener against the Thunder Friday, October 29th. We're blowing out your Pistons home opener tickets every hour till midnight, starting at 11 a.m. with Ann Carlini. Pistons home opener Monday. Listen and win from your Detroit Pistons and 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Hello.
How are you?
It's you and Mike. Enjoy your weekend, and Monday morning we'll see how the spot came out, as well as Michigan and those Detroit Lions as well. And, of course, more Monday morning with us, Joe and Mike at 101 WRIF Detroit.
Drew and Mike in the morning.
That's inspirational stuff.
101 WRIF.
Come on, get it up now.
Everything that rocks. 101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. There's certain aspects of American history that have become iconic. They're just part of the national story. The Revolutionary War, abolitionist movement, the Civil War, the labor movement, and of course the civil rights movement. And when things become iconic, people pretty much think they know it all. I mean, don't we all know the history of our Constitution and the Revolutionary War? Well, we don't, but we think we do. And that's true through all of the aspects of history. The stories are immense, complex, and even what some of the aspects of individual periods that we think are pretty simple, they have a complexity to it as well. That's why I was really glad to get this book by Danielle L. McGuire. It's called At the Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. And the Civil Rights Movement, again, moved into the iconic category where we all know what happened. Martin Luther King came to Montgomery. There were sit-ins in North Carolina, and then President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Bill, and that was it. Well, not the case. It's a very, very complex story, and this adds something to it that I think is incredibly unique. Joining me is Danielle L. McGuire, the author at the Dark End of the Street, and she is an assistant professor in the history department at Wayne State University right here in Detroit. She received her Ph.D. from Rutgers in 2007. She's the winner of numerous awards for her scholarship, and she is a distinguished lecturer for the Organization of American Historians, and she lives here in Metro Detroit. We have her on the phone because she's got a couple of little kids to take care of. Danielle L. McGuire, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
This, such in many ways. One end of it is just so horrible. Of course, there is just hope in the resistance and all. But when people think about rape and African Americans and the civil rights movement, it's usually black men who were accused of raping white women and were lynched. Tell us about At the Dark End of the Street, Black Women and Rape. What's that all about?
Well, it's a new look at the civil rights movement that really puts black women and their struggle for dignity and respect and bodily integrity at the forefront of the freedom movement. What I found when I was doing research was that from slavery through the better part of the 20th century, white men in the segregated South abducted and assaulted black women with alarming regularity and usually with impunity. And, you know, this is something that I thought happened mostly in slavery. I wasn't sure that it continued throughout the 20th century after slavery ended, but it did. In fact, whites used rape often as a weapon of terror to terrorize the black community. And there are two sides to it. One side is the way that whites used the fear of interracial rape to create this myth that black men were rapists, that they used to justify lynching and attacking black men. And the flip side of that is the way that white men abducted and assaulted black women, also to terrorize the black community and to assert their own power. So rape really sits at the center of the modern-day freedom struggle, and interracial rape in many ways became a battleground in which whites and blacks fought for dignity and respect and bodily integrity.
Now, there's an interesting aspect to it. Black men by whites were seen almost less, in fact, I shouldn't say almost, were seen less than human, yet to white men, black women were objects of desire. That's a kind of a weird psychoanalytic pairing, I would think. Yeah.
Right. And that happened, you know, that was true throughout slavery. I mean, African Americans were considered property. You know, they were slaves. They could be bought and sold like a commodity. But most commodities can't run away, right? Most commodities don't commit murder. Most commodities won't fight you if you try to control them. So I think whites always understood that they were human. They just did everything in their power to try to dehumanize them. And so sexual violence is one of the tools that whites use to dehumanize black men and black women.
Now, it almost sounds the way you're posing it, that it was like a conscious strategy, that we had a population, a subjugated population with no rights, and one of the ways that we could keep them in check would be to launch rapes against the women. Was it that distinct, do you think?
I'm not sure if it was that distinct during the 20th century. It certainly is that distinct during slavery. You know, white men had a financial incentive to sexually abuse their slave women because any of the children born by black women would become the property of their masters. So they made money if their slaves had children. So, you know, they had an incentive to do this. What I found is that after the slavery ended, the practices that went with slavery, including sexual violence, often remain. And so during Reconstruction, whites used rape as a weapon of terror to destroy the nascent black political struggle. And whites continued to use either the fear of black men as rapists or, you know, rape as a weapon of terror against black women in order to maintain their power and control. What I found throughout the entire time I was researching this, which was about 12 years, was that this had an almost ritualistic tone, that the way the black women were attacked was similar in almost every case across every state throughout the South. So if it wasn't a ritual, if it wasn't something that was planned or something that was, you know, strategic, then it was certainly something that fathers and grandfathers passed on to their sons grandsons.
What was the pattern that were you're describing?
Very simple. There's basically three patterns. One is that white men abducted and assaulted black women while they were walking home from church or work or school. And two, they sexually humiliated and assaulted them on buses and streetcars and in other public places. And three, they would often lure them out of their homes or workplaces with promises of better wages or a better job. And then, you know, if the woman agreed, they would often take them, you know, somewhere outside of town and rape them. This often happened, that I found, most often with young black women who were propositioned by white men to be babysitters.
Are we talking over the span of years? I mean, it probably was considerable, but are we talking about dozens, hundreds, thousands? Is there any way to quantify it?
I don't think there's any way to quantify it because, as you know, just like today, a lot of women don't talk about their experiences with sexual violence. There is a lot of silence.
They couldn't go to the police usually, right?
They could go to the police all the time, but often black women did. I mean, I think what's astounding is that for every woman who remained silent, there was at least, you know, one who testified about what happened to her. So you have this, you know, contrast between the silence surrounding sexual violence, which is certainly there, but then there are also black women who spoke out and had been speaking out since slavery. And we've got testimonies from slave narratives, from Harriet Jacobs, you know, to Ida B. Wells in the 1900s and late 19th century, all the way through the civil rights movement. So this is something that happened for a long time. And as many women were silent, there were women who spoke out.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in your book, At the Dark End of the Street. And by the way, you can go to atthedarkendofthestreet.com. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, to the book. Danielle L. McGuire is my guest, and that this quality of projection, I mean, the whites projected the idea of the black male as having this voracious sexual appetite that that it was only constrained by the laws of the South and segregation. Tell us a little about that, about what you talk about projection.
Yeah, I think that what you see is, you know, whites are using this myth of the black men as rapists, and they use it, like I say, to justify lynching. They use it to justify keeping African Americans, you know, in a so-called place. But what really was happening, I mean, if they were worried about interracial rape, they should have turned the focus onto themselves, because what whites were doing was raping black women. And so they projected their own crimes and their own deviant behaviors onto black men and women, I think, to maintain their own political, social, and economic power. So, you know, there was an old joke that went around among African Americans in the 1940s that the closer a black man got to a ballot box, the more he looked like a rapist.
Mm.
And that was, you know, they joked about it, but it was very true. I mean, African Americans had to be very careful about asserting their rights granted by the Constitution, because as soon as they did, it was often, you know, argued that they were dangerous, mostly to white women. So, again, like, I think what happened is, because you've got whites committing all these crimes, they took their crimes and their behaviors and they just projected them onto African Americans and then used those projections to maintain their own control.
Well, let's look a little at the subtitle of At the Dark End of the Street by Danielle L. McGuire. It's published by Knopf, by the way. And that is Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. Now, most of us think we all know about Rosa Parks. She was a tired woman and just 2 feet were aching too much to give up her her seat to a white man. And this is what I was talking about, you know, a real event becoming iconic and entering into national mythology. There was a lot more to Rosa Parks than I think most of us realize.
That's right. Rosa Parks is so much more interesting and so much more complex than popular history textbooks give her credit for. She joined the NAACP in 1943 after she had tried and failed to register to vote multiple times. She finally registered to vote that same year. She was elected branch secretary, and we usually think of secretaries as just taking notes and filing papers. I mean, that's our stereotype of them. But Rosa Parks' role as secretary was really as a detective. And what she did during the 1940s was travel the back roads of Alabama documenting acts of racial brutality and taking notes from people who were victims of these kinds of acts of violence. And she would take those notes back to the Montgomery branch and talk to E.D. Nixon, who was the president, and they would decide whether or not to press legal charges or to launch a public protest. And often their public protests and their campaigns led to larger campaigns for civil and human rights. So the Montgomery bus boycott, something that we tend to think of as the opening act of the civil rights drama, really is part of a decades-long struggle led by Rosa Parks and her allies to protect black women from sexual violence, because they had been active in trying to get white men sent to jail or at least to be held accountable on some level for their attacks on black women since the early 1940s.
And usually when white men ever got as far as court, they were almost routinely found not guilty, of course. But tell us, there was this brutal gang rape of a young mother named Recy Taylor that really begins the Rosa Parks story. Could you tell us that briefly?
Sure. In 1944, in Abbeville, Alabama, Recy Taylor, an African-American woman and sharecropper mother, was walking home from a church revival. And a car full of white men kidnapped her off the street, they drove her to the woods, and they gang raped her at gunpoint. When they were finished, they dropped her off in the middle of town, and they told her if she told anybody what happened, they would kill her. Now, this was a serious threat at the time, so you would expect Recy Taylor to remain silent about what happened, but she didn't. She went home, she told her father, her husband, and she told the local sheriff the details of the assault. Now, the local sheriff didn't do much, but the Montgomery NAACP heard about what happened, and they called and they said, "We promise we're sending our very best investigator to look into it." A couple days later, Rosa Parks showed up on Recy Taylor's doorstep. It was 1944. It was 11 years before the bus boycott. So, you know, Rosa Parks and her allies in Montgomery, they cut their political teeth defending women like Recy Taylor. They launched a campaign that the Chicago Defender called the strongest struggle for equal justice to be seen in a decade.
This was a black newspaper in Chicago.
This was a black newspaper.
Very prominent.
That's right. They compared it only to Scottsboro, which was a huge national and international campaign to free nine black youths from
accusations of rape.
Right, exactly.
Same thing, right.
In the 1930s. So this was a huge campaign. And what I found was that Rosa Parks was involved in defending black women like Gracie Taylor in 1944, in 1946, in 1949 with a case against a black woman named Gertrude Perkins, in 1951 with a black teenager who was raped by a man who employed her as a babysitter, and, you know, throughout the 1950s. So it's really fascinating. Now, the connection to the bus boycott is that the buses were sites of sexual violence. This is the place where black women, particularly working-class black women, had no choice. They had no choice but to ride the buses. They didn't have cars, and they all had to take the buses to the other side of town to work in white women's homes. So bus drivers and often police officers were the assailants. And, you know, there weren't a lot of rapes on the buses, but that's where black women were harassed and humiliated. They were slapped. They were disrespected. They were touched inappropriately. Drivers sometimes exposed themselves to black women. So they're sites of sexual violence. And if we want to understand why so many women stayed off the buses in 1955 and 1956, we need to understand the way that they were treated by white men and this long history of sexual abuse and harassment on the buses.
Now, it when I've heard stories of women that I've known that have been sexually assaulted, I mean, and they're not my family, they're not my my wife, I mean, the anger that rises in me, I mean, to be, well, at least in the cases among friends of mine that's occurred to, we have a law enforcement establishment up here that attempts to deal with it somewhat. In the South, a black family, a father that this has happened to his daughter, a husband or a brother, the rage on their part must have been intense. Did you, because what we should tell people, you've interviewed the book At the Dark Side of the Street also has an enormous number of interviews of people that lived through the period, and how did the black men respond to this?
It's interesting. Reese Taylor's father, Benny Corbett, begged his daughter to move in with the family and leave her home with her husband and children. And they did. They moved in with her father after whites firebombed their front porch. So she was a target for continued attack, and so were the other women that I talk about. They were all targets for violence after they spoke out. So Reese Taylor moves in with her father. Her father basically knew that he couldn't fight back the way he wanted to because it would cost him his life, and it might cost him his other children's lives as well. So what he did is every night when the family went to sleep, he climbed up an old tree in his backyard with his shotgun and a sack of shells, and he guarded the house. He protected his family from white night riders, and that kept them alive. And, you know, when I was interviewing them, they talked about little things that they did to let, you know, the sheriff and other folks in town know what happened because they were neighbors and they did business with these people. And they often, you know, the black women in the family took an ironing from the sheriff and from the store owner who was a witness to the events. So they had interactions every day and their anger would sometimes boil over. One little story is Benny Corbett often killed chickens for a white family in town, the store owner, Will Cook. And Will Cook, you know, denied that this happened to Reese Taylor despite the fact that he was a witness. He didn't stand up for her. So one day when Will Cook's wife asked Benny Corbett to get her some chickens, he took a box full of chickens over to their front yard and he stood on their front lawn and he ripped the necks off the chickens and threw each head down on the ground.
Wow.
And the white woman just stood there, you know, struck by shock, you know, at what he was doing. But that was his way of saying, how dare you assault my daughter, you know, in a way that wouldn't get him killed.
I wonder if everybody thinks in the terms I'm going to pose right now, but there in what you've described, I mean, it's virtually it was a reign of terror, wasn't it? The way that African-American people were kept in their place was old-fashioned terrorism on this broad social and cultural scale. It's just
absolutely.
And Reese Taylor, you actually were able to interview her for At the Dark End of the Street. She's alive, and she was willing to relate her story.
That's right. She'll be 91 this year, this December, and she's still living with the pain of this attack, you know, 60, 70 years ago. She's still struggling for justice. The family is still looking for ways that they could prosecute in, you know, one way or another, the families who are responsible for this. There's no statute of limitations for rape in Alabama, although I don't think it's possible to continue the case. But, you know, for them, Abbeville is a crime scene. Yeah. When I went to visit them, they drove me around town. They knew, you know, they pointed out the houses where the assailants lived and sometimes still live. They took me to the woods where she was attacked and showed me the spot where she was gang raped. And so, you know, this is very real to them. This is not ancient history. This is something that is very, very real to them. And they're still struggling with it. You know, time has passed and they've moved on with their lives, thankfully, for their own well-being. But it's still very painful for them.
When that happened in 1944, was it?
Mm-hmm, 1944.
That almost all whites were probably indistinguishable, except for maybe a few, in their attitudes towards black people. Yet here you, a white woman, came and wanted to interview them, and they accepted you as someone like them seeking justice. Do you think their attitudes have changed over the years towards white people as a category?
Yeah, I think if you talk to them and ask them how they feel about whites, they're very specific about, you know, who they hold grudges against. I mean, they don't hold grudges against the children of the assailants. They're like, you know, look, they're not responsible for what happened. And they frequent their businesses in town. But they do hold, you know, the men who did this responsible and continue to sort of focus their wrath on them. They were very open with me. They never asked me any questions. They didn't seem, you know, distrustful or, you know, they didn't make any assumptions about me. They were very open and very grateful that somebody was willing to reopen the case and look into it and try to get the facts because they had been left in the dark for so long.
Danielle McGuire is my guest. The book is At the Dark End of the Street. And if you just put a .com after it, you'll get to the website. And, Dr. McGuire teaches at Wayne State University. She's in the history department, and one of her colleagues is a friend of mine, someone who's been on this show a few times, Dr. Francis Shore. And he was telling me about, he was presenting some material about the civil rights movement just yesterday. And he said, they just didn't look too engaged. And I said, you know, Fran, it's probably like talking about the abolitionist movement to them. I mean, that none of the students were even alive when any of this was occurring. But as a scholar, you're relatively young as well. What got you so interested in this then, and to do the incredible amount of work that you did on it?
You know, I was always fascinated by the civil rights movement. Once I got into college and got away from the way the textbooks present the civil rights movement, which is real sappy and simple, and I started learning about the ordinary people who took, you know, extraordinary risks to change the world that they lived in, it really spoke to me, and I thought, this is really something. If ordinary people without power, without any access to legal remedies for nearly anything that happened in their lives, if they could fight and change the world that they live in, if they could tear down segregation, then I need to know who those people are. I need to know how they did it because it was so inspiring to me. So the civil rights movement spoke to me, you know, and I wanted to speak to it. And I was fascinated by this movement. I was listening to an NPR show in 1998, and I heard a veteran of the Montgomery bus boycott talking about his experience, and he said, you know, Gertrude Perkins is never mentioned in the history books, but she had as much to do with the boycott as anyone on earth. And I wondered who Gertrude Perkins was. You know, I'd never learned anything about her, even as an undergraduate in college. And what I found out was that she was a black woman who was raped by two white Montgomery police officers in 1949, and people like Rosa Parks and Edie Nixon and Reverend Solomon Say launched a public protest to defend her, and that was part of, you know, this movement leading up to the bus boycott. So I wanted to know if that happened elsewhere and if other women told their stories. And I found that that was true. And so I investigated cases in Tallahassee in 1959, in Hattiesburg, Mississippi in the 1960s. I looked at the way Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee members, black women who were volunteers for voter registration during the 1964 Freedom Summer, were attacked if they were sent to jail. You know, all kinds of different things in the civil rights movement that we hadn't really learned about, partly because I think we weren't interested in using a lens of sexual violence to look at the movement, but also because we get so focused on the national leaders and the notable organizations that play such a prominent role in our popular history. We don't like to move past that, and I think it's just so much more exciting and interesting if we can look at what ordinary people are really concerned about.
Indeed. Rosa Parks, of course, as you relate in At the Dark End of the Street, is investigating rapes of black women by white men in the middle 40s, and certainly her life probably, or being, possibility of her being victimized as well. Yet she left Montgomery 2 years after the boycott that she was such a memorable part of and came here to Detroit. Why did she leave Montgomery?
She left Montgomery because there were constant death threats against her. She got called every single day. The phone rang off the hook with people who threatened to kill her, to do damage to her husband or her home, family members. And her brother, who lived in Detroit at the time, called her and said, you know, Rosa, Whitey's going to get you. Those were his words. That's what he said. He's like, you've got to leave. And I think after one too many death threats, she finally decided, you know what, he's right, I've got to go. So she came up here, and she continued organizing for justice, as many Detroiters know. And I was shocked to find out that in 1974, she helped to organize the Detroit branch of the Free Joanne Little Committee. Now, Joanne Little was an African-American inmate in Washington, North Carolina, who was sexually assaulted by the white jailer. And he came into her cell with an ice pick and threatened her. She managed to get the ice pick away, and she stabbed him to death. She was put on trial for murder. And Rosa Parks helped launch the Detroit branch of the organization to defend her. So here Rosa Parks is, 30 years after the Abbeville incident with Recy Taylor, doing the same work. So it wasn't, you know, an anomaly for her to do that work in the 1940s. She continued it through the rest of her life.
Let's do this. We got about 30 seconds left, and there's so much that we've left unsaid. That's why, because there is a book at the dark end of the street. Is there hope at the end of the book?
I think so. There's a steady progress towards justice, and in the beginning, you know, white people wouldn't even hear Recy Taylor's trial. By the end, I can't tell you the end, but by the end, things have really changed.
An extraordinary book. It's written by Danielle L. McGuire, At the Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. And Kevin Boyle, who we've interviewed for his incredible book about Detroit, Arc of Justice, A Saga of Race, Civil Rights, and Murder in the Jazz Age. At the Dark End of the Street is one of those rare studies that makes a well-known story seem startlingly new. It's a wonderful endorsement from a great historian and writer. And Danielle McGuire, thanks for joining me on The Peter Werby Show.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Join Mark and Mike from the Rich Drew and Mike Show and Taco Bell live at the AAA branch on South Main in Ann Arbor for all U of M home games. Now is a great time to join AAA and save on auto, home, and life insurance. Call the AAA office in Ann Arbor at 734-930-2250. Go Blue with 101 WRIF. The Riff.
Feels like time's running out. Maxed out on your credit cards, collection calls are coming every day, and you're two payments behind on your mortgage. You need help. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. Call Credit Card Relief right now. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. Call 866-290-8282. That's 866-290-8282.
101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Water is all around us. No wonder it's hard to imagine we're facing a water crisis. But we are. So that's why the American Planning Association brings you simple ways to save water at home and in your community. Learn more at planning.org. That's planning.org. A public service message from this station and the American Planning Association.
Dad, can I ask you something?
Sure.
There's this girl I kind of like.
Say no more.
You just have to impress her. Okay, but how?
Just, I don't know, pick up a lot of heavy things around her.
Like what?
You know, desks, chairs, people. Grunt if you have to.
Grunt?
Yeah, be like, There you go.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. When you adopt a child from foster care, just being there makes all the difference. To learn more, call 1-888-200-4005. A public service announcement brought to you by Adopt U.S. Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. Some of you may remember that I cited a study was done, I think, 2 years ago now, and they where people responded that they would rather have their daughter marry a Muslim. And given all the prejudices we have of people that adhere to Islam, think about this. They'd rather have their daughter marry a Muslim than an atheist. So atheists were really at the bottom of the heap. I mean, the question is, if God is dead, isn't everything and anything permissible? Don't we need a spiritual understanding and ethically centered life in order to not be immoral people? Well, there's about 40 million of us, and I'm a non-believer, so I include myself in that. And I've never had children, but I always wondered, I mean, I was brought up in a home where neither religion nor God played any role. But I always wondered how other people went at it. Well, here's an extraordinarily interesting book came my way. It's called Parenting Beyond Belief on Raising Ethical, Caring Kids Without Religion. It's edited by Dale McGowan, and Dale McGowan is joining us. He's a writer, editor, and critical thinking educator in Minneapolis. His satirical novel, Calling Bernadette's Bluff, has been called, quote, an undoubted triumph of satire and wickedly funny. He's the father of three, and he and his wife are the father of three, so he has some direct experience in this. Dale McGowan, thanks for joining us from Minneapolis.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Peter. Thanks.
Well, so maybe we could just begin, as they say, the personal is political. You, as a non-believer, and tell me if I'm not characterizing you correctly, have three children, so you were faced with raising ethical, caring kids without religion. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So tell us how this intersected in your personal lives, you and your wife, raising children, and also with the generation of this book, Parenting Beyond Belief.
Well, it was an issue. I've actually been a non-believer for a good 25 years. I've been a parent for about 12. So it became an issue once those two intersected, and I went looking for resources. There are a lot of things that come up right away living in a predominantly religious culture, and trying to raise kids to negotiate and navigate those straits. And I just didn't find anything out there to help out with it. So I began pulling together some ideas for the book and writing some essays, and I had a couple of them published online and so on, but still wanted to get something that was going to have even a wider point of view than I was able to give myself. So I eventually came up with the idea of pulling together contributors, eventually ended up with about 25 people from a wide range of spectrums within disbelief, all talking about this issue of raising kids without religion.
And how does it work in your household? And maybe I could even tell you after you tell me, I'll tell you how it worked in mine.
Oh, sure. The question of religion is the same as the question of everything else I want my kids to encounter. I want them to have all the information they possibly can and think for themselves. And that means I have to avoid trying to put my point of view in a position of just being something they glom onto. If they do that, it's going to be on a very weak foundation. So if they appear to be heading too far in the direction of what I believe, I try to throw them some information from the other side or have them seek out the information from other people outside. So it's no different in religion than any other way. When we're talking about questions of God and faith and so on, and they've heard my point of view, I then say, hey, why don't you go talk to Grandma Barbara? I know she thinks differently. You can get some more information from her.
Mm-hmm. Now, you teach critical thinking, and that you just gave an example of it. On the other hand, some people might say, well, that's a great way to confuse kids because you have these authority figures, us adults, and you got Dad saying, no God, sorry, ain't happening. It's all a myth. And then you got Grandma saying, yes, you know, the Lord will have us in his hands and you know, we'll all meet in heaven. I mean, now what? How does a child know how to sort that all out?
Oh, they do just fine. I think it's like so many things. Whatever model a kid sees from the beginning, they accept as normal. And if they accept as normal the idea that adults come to different conclusions, then they recognize that they have the right to come to various conclusions on their own. It won't be something that's strange. If instead they're born into a situation where dad's the authority and whatever dad says goes, then they confront the kind of the messy world of ideas later on, and it can be quite confusing. But my kids have never had any trouble with the idea that there are lots of different landing places, and it's up to them to decide where they go.
Mm-hmm. Dale McGowan is my guest, and he has edited Parenting Beyond Belief on Raising Ethical, Caring Kids Without Religion. And we'll talk about some of the contributors to the book in just a little while. I know when I was growing up, when I was small, that the United States being one of the more religious Western countries in the world, that I always felt kind of on the outside, not believing in anything. I don't remember any discussions. I think I probably just asked my mother or dad, did God exist? And they probably just said, no. And that was it. But I know when I lived in a Christian, predominantly Christian neighborhood, and kids went to church every Sunday, and my parents were very liberal, and they said, well, you can go to church if you want. Instead, I went to a YMCA camp, and remember just being kind of frightened by the imagery and the threats of going to hell, because I was a bad little boy. And then we moved into a predominantly Jewish neighborhood, and all of the kids were about to have bar mitzvahs, and I wondered, then I found out that the people went to services, they went to Hebrew school after school, and they went to services on Saturday. I said, that doesn't sound good to me. I told it a bit for humor, but actually I felt like an outsider. I felt like I was, and a couple of times in situations like in the Boy Scouts, I was confronted by adults demanding to know how could I put forth such a preposterous proposition that God did not exist.
Yeah.
So how do your kids interact with essentially a religious country?
Well, it's there are a whole range of topics in there in the things you were describing, and
sure.
I think it varies depending on which one you're talking about. Really, if there's one overriding challenge in raising kids without religion, it's that whole barrel of monkeys right there. How do you deal with the intersection of religion and your family life? So it's not difficult at all to raise children who are ethical and caring. It's not difficult to talk about death and so on. But then, like you say, interacting with the outside world, interacting with the Boy Scouts, for example. My boy was a Cub Scout initially, and he began to be uncomfortable with the way this religious pledge has become even a higher profile recently than it used to be. And we talked it out, and he said, I really don't want to be a part of it anymore. And it wasn't just about that. It was about some other things as well. But he ended up making a choice. We gave it entirely over to him, and he decided that was just not something he was comfortable with. Then you've got things like the Pledge of Allegiance. The book talks about several different ways to handle the Pledge of Allegiance thing, including letting the child simply go through the ritual of saying under God or whatever it is. There are all sorts of possibilities. Some people decide that they want to take a stand and want to help their child to take a stand, and others are saying, well, you really need to find out where the child is, and it depends on how old they are, how much they're willing to take on. So one of the things I like most about the way the book came together is that there isn't a single voice. It's a lot of people advocating different ways of approaching these topics.
Well, yeah. Dale McGowan, this is being aired on Sunday. I suspect some people are probably either going or coming from church. And one of the reasons that people say to me that why they've started going to a church or synagogue, or in some cases, well, I guess just churches or synagogues in the terms of the people I know, is that they say, well, you know, I never really went, but I'm raising kids and I want to give them some ethical grounding. And the assumption there is you're going to be raising some, insufficient human beings if they don't see Ten Commandments, don't do this, don't do that, don't do this. Speak to them. I mean, there's people riding home in the car, they're coming from church, and how are you going to raise an ethical, caring kid if you don't have the grounding of religion?
Well, first of all, one of the things that I try to make clear in the book is that if there is someone who believes that's the case, then they should go for it. That's if that's what they want. I'm not trying to recruit anybody away from religion. But those who have decided to be outside of it find no difficulty whatsoever raising ethical kids. What you do is you teach children that ethics are grounded in reason. And the fact is, this is no different from religious parents. I have religious parents look at me in one moment, friends of mine, and say, gosh, without the Ten Commandments, I'd have no idea what was right and wrong. And then they turn around to their child and say, don't hit Billy. How would you feel if he hit you?
Yeah.
You know, they just explained a reason to be good. The fact is, all of our ethics are grounded in reason, and we all explain the reasons to our children, explain to them why it's important to be good. And then religious parents simply add this coda. They say, well, and God wants us to treat each other well. It's not the centerpiece even of their own ethical teaching. So there's really no trouble in doing it without that coda.
Is there any, I just thought of this off the top of my head, I don't get this, I haven't read all the essays in your book, Parenting Beyond Belief, but is there any like studies or statistics as how this all falls in terms of criminality or other things that we would all agree are social negatives and how people are, you know, believers or not? Is it?
Yeah, there are a couple of studies along those lines. One of them that's very interesting is simply a one study took a look at the prison population in the U.S. They looked at federal prisons, and upon admission to the institution, prisoners are asked what their religious preference is, so that if they die or are in some need of a religious figure, they know which way to send them. And actually, in that study, there are about the same percentage of Catholics in the federal penitentiary system as there are in the population. There are about the same percentage of Protestants as there are in the population. But there are 80 times fewer atheists in the prison system than you would expect given the number in the population. So if you take that indication alone, these are tremendously, if anything, ethically obsessed people. I know dozens and dozens of atheists and humanists who I would count among the most ethically concerned people I know. And that's why the popular misconception is so preposterous and unfortunate, because these are people who actually think about their ethics, who actually try to figure out why it is that we should be good and why we should take care of each other, because there's no divine safety net. One of the other studies that that I think is important is the piece on commandments versus principles, and they talk about the fact that a sociologist set up a study in which there were moral dilemmas and presented it to people in the study to determine what was the right action and the wrong action in a given situation. There's a train that's running out of control toward a person on the tracks, and you can either save the five people on the train or the one person on the track and so on. And what he did is determined how different the answers were between religious people and people who did not have a religious affiliation. And the key finding of the study was that there was essentially no statistical difference whatsoever. These people were making the same kind of judgments in the same situations, regardless of their religious upbringing or lack thereof.
Hmm. The book is Parenting Beyond Belief, pardon me, on raising ethical, caring kids without religion. My guest is Dale McGowan, and he's edited an incredible array of essays, and I keep promising we're gonna get to them. I have just maybe one more little aspect till we get into some of the contributors, and that is when I said earlier the United States is designated as the most religious of the Western nations. In fact, very, very few people in European countries are religious. Very, you know, the church attendance is getting close to zero in some European countries, but here, almost when people like Sam Harris's book, Letter to a Christian Nation, that he cites these statistics of what percentage of people believe in hell and the return of Jesus in our lifetime and all of that. And, you know, I wonder what you think about that, Dale McGowan, because I tend to think that a lot of the expressed religiosity is about a mile wide but an inch deep. And just one little example, there was a news story that I read this last New Year's, where there was this huge revelry going on in the streets of Las Vegas, and some women had their tops off, and it was like Sodom and Gomorrah. It was like the worst imaginable to, you know, to a devout religious person situation one could imagine. And there were these two preachers there that started telling people, you know, you're sinning, you're going to hell. And these, you know, predominantly young people were outraged that these preachers came in their midst, and they said, who are they to tell us how to live our lives? But I suspect if you went to each one of these young people, the woman without the top, the guy, you know, guzzling beer, and you said to him, do you believe in God? He'd probably say, huh? Oh, yeah. Do you believe in the divinity of Jesus? Yeah. Do you think that the Bible is the divine word of God? Yes, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
What, can you speak to that at all?
Well, you're actually speaking to my primary audience. I honestly believe that the numbers, the statistics cited, 30 to 40 million non-believers in the U.S. are way low. But in fact, people have, like you said, about an inch deep religiosity. They don't know there's an alternative. They, especially parents, that's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, they have no idea that there is an ethical mainstream alternative to simply dragging yourself to church and muttering that you believe. And I want to show in as many ways as possible that there are an awful lot of people out there doing this already, and that everything that's achieved by going to church or by muttering those religious words can be achieved without it. And I think Europe, you mentioned European countries, it's a wonderful example. If you look at the Scandinavian countries, it's a fascinating statistic that they have the lowest church attendance in the Western world and the highest percentage of giving to the poor and also giving to poor nations internationally. They have the lowest rates of violent crime. They have the lowest rates of things like teen pregnancy and so on. I don't think that's a coincidence. I think these are countries in which ethics are articulated, and these are people living a moral life without religion, and they can do it because they are surrounded by other people who are doing it, and they know that it's not that big a deal to simply let go of the lip service that you pay to religious ideas.
All right, let's go into the book. The book is Parenting Beyond Belief on Raising Ethical, Caring Kids Without Religion. It's edited by Dale McGowan, our guest on the Peter Werbe Show. If you want to see more about this book, you can go to parentingbeyondbelief.com, parentingbeyondbelief.com. There'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. You assembled over 20 essays to speak to this, to how to parent beyond belief. And I just opened just randomly to page 142. And one of the things you want to look at it are what kind of role models do we have for people that have made a difference in our world? And here is a list of non-believers, atheists, free thinkers, what agnostics, whatever you would want to call them, American revolutionaries, celebrities, novelists, reformers, and scientists, feminists. Those of us who are free thinkers or non-believers, we certainly have, and children certainly have a lot of people to be put forth as role models.
Oh, absolutely. That's why I wanted to include that piece especially. Annie Laurie Gaylor wrote that, who could have written on a dozen different topics, but this is something that's systematically erased from our history. We know about Thomas Edison, we know about Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, we know all these figures, but we only assume that they were observant Christians. In the case of those names and this incredible chapter of additional names, they were not. They were religious doubters of various stripes. And I think it makes a tremendous difference. I didn't know this myself until I was in my early 30s and started uncovering this incredible history of disbelief. But we sort of systematically go through and erase that from our history as much as possible to give the impression that everybody is a pious believer.
Yeah, the novelists, the list of novelists, which I won't read because it would probably take to the end of the show, both right-wingers like Ayn Rand and people more associated with the left, Gore Vidal and Kurt Vonnegut and Alice Walker and H.G. Wells going back a ways, just a tremendous number of people. So, this is not set up as a program, nor is the book, to attack people that are religious. Am I correct?
No, absolutely. One of the reasons is that there's no point. It's as if I want to put my energy into converting people, I would have taken a very different approach. What I want to do is say there's already an enormous underserved population here, and there's no reason for us to create a book that attacks the beliefs of somebody else. The idea here is to say, okay, we are here together. We've arrived at this point in our own beliefs. How can we raise the best possible children? So no, it doesn't have to engage in religious attack.
And there's a minister somewhere. He was, I can't remember the story completely. The man that says that Jesus died for our sins, all of us, atheists, mass murderers, Hindus and Buddhists. So that's it. If it turns out we're wrong, Dale, according to him, we're taken care of. Anyway, tell us about some of the essays. Probably the most famous one is Richard Dawkins, whose book, The God Delusion, has been on the New York Times bestseller list for the longest time. He writes open letters, so to speak, to an 11-year-old.
Right, that's right, to his daughter, on good and bad reasons for believing. It's a wonderful piece.
Yeah, yeah. And tell us about some of the other people that we may have heard of as well.
Sure. Well, there's Julia Sweeney, formerly of Saturday Night Live. She's begun, in the last few years, she's really become more vocal about her own disbelief and about her moving away from Catholicism. And so her essay is the first one in the book, and it's just terrific. It's just wonderful, personal, funny, and poignant piece. And Julia was the first one I contacted. I wanted to see if she'd be able to do this. She got back to me in 90 minutes with a yes. This is the kind of reaction I had from all the contributors. I let them know about the idea, and it took them virtually no time to say yes. They all just said it was long overdue. Some of the others, we've got Penn Jillette, of course, passing down the joy of not collecting stamps. Just a great piece. He's just a brilliant guy, and he's got this no-holds-barred, no-nonsense approach to the thing that...
This is from Penn and Teller.
From Penn and Teller, right. Yeah, exactly. So those are kind of bookends in the personal reflections chapter. We've got Julia Sweeney, who's got this kind of, you know, oh, gosh, I didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings, you know, approach, and Penn Jillette, who really doesn't care. So you can find yourself in any one of the approaches there.
Well, do you think that there's been a sea change? I mentioned a couple of years ago, I don't know if you saw that study, where people put atheists at the bottom rung of acceptable partners for their children.
Yeah.
Yet, I think with all the hypocrisy that has been come forth, the corruption about the politicized right-wing Christians, that suddenly atheism, the books about it, Dawkins and others have hit the bestseller list. Synchronicity that Parenting Beyond Belief has come out now.
Yeah.
I think suddenly non-believers are getting a hearing.
Yeah, I think that's true. When the first Bush election in 2000, I remember being at this convention, being surrounded by all these moping progressives, and I just said, this is a great time. This is actually the best possible thing for us because now it's out in the open. You know, there are all sorts of horrible things that are going to come out of it, but in another way, it's not under the surface anymore. We can really, really see the results of this kind of nonsense, and that's going to be a painful thing to go through. Believe me, I haven't enjoyed it. But in another way, it's allowed us to finally get off our butts and start articulating our point of view instead of doing this sort of wishy-washy, you know, on the sidelines thing. I think that's also permitted a large number of people who've been in the middle and haven't really thought too much about these issues to say, you know what, I'm willing to recognize that there are actually some harmful effects of religion that I want to stay away from, and that when we start to get it involved in the government, it's an atrocious thing.
Yeah, well, I always say one nation under God, Iran. That's one of your worst examples. Yeah, it historically, the intertwining of the political state and religion has always corrupted both of them.
Right.
Without a doubt. We only got about a minute or so left. Have you had any reaction to your book, Parenting Beyond Belief, either positive or negative? I know it's just come out.
Yeah, well, it's been out for about 6 weeks, I guess, and there's been a lot of reaction, and I've been stunned at how positive it's been across the board. I was prepared. I was getting my arguments ready and prepared from either side, both from atheists who would think it's occasionally too accommodating of religion and from religious people who think that it's too disdainful. And there hasn't really been much of that at all. People tend to say, you know what? If this is a resource that's needed to make parents better parents, then more power to you. There's been a lot more of that than any of the negatives, so I've been pleased.
Well, I noticed that you have an essay by Dan Barker and also one by Ann Nicole Gaylor, both who have been on my show a couple of times,
right, great.
Who are the co-directors of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and their organization it has just been growing by leaps and bounds.
Yeah. I mean,
thousands and thousands of people. So, I mean, you think it is sort of a coming out of the closet?
Yeah, I think there's been a critical mass reached in some way. There's what you have to do, it makes sense no matter what topic you're talking about. Nobody wants to plunge in and be alone. And if you can really feel like there's a community around you, other people who are coming to the same conclusions, it makes it much more possible for people to come out and say, yeah, you know what, I don't believe either.
Now, you have on the back, ooh, do we have time? I don't even think I have time for this question. I've got so many questions, but that's why you wrote a book. That's why you edited the book with so many engaging and challenging, particularly for the religious, so many challenging essays in this Parenting Beyond Belief subtitle, and this is the important part for you parents, on raising ethical, caring kids without religion. It's edited by my guest, Dale McGowan, and that's McGowan. Best way to get at it, parentingbeyondbelief.com, parentingbeyondbelief.com. There'll also be a link on my website, peterwerby.com. Dale, thanks for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Oh, absolutely. I've been glad to be here.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Do people sometimes describe you as a saver, a bit frugal, penny-wise, and somewhat thrifty?
You know, cheap.
If that sounds like you, you're going to love the newest addition to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Coupon crazy!
At MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, you'll still find great gift certificates for local businesses with goods and services on sale for more than half off. Find money-saving online coupons that you can download right now and start saving immediately. Log on to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com and save big.
With online coupons from Autolab USA, with over 20 locations in the Metro Detroit area and a 12,000-mile, 12-month warranty. Hagopian Rug Care Center with 5 locations in Metro Detroit. They're the leader in carpet, rug, furniture, and tile cleaning.
If you're looking for ways to enjoy life and stay within your budget, then go
coupon crazy
now at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com. That's MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, your online home for great ways to save big at local Michigan businesses.
Most WRIF contests are open to legal U.S. residents at least 18 years old. Winners may win only one contest every 30 days or every 6 months for prizes worth $600 or more. Employees and their family of Greater Media Detroit, its advertising agencies, and other radio stations in the metro area may not participate. No purchase necessary. Prizes are not transferable, and rules are subject to change at any time. Complete rules are available online at WRIF.com or at the WRIF studios during regular business hours.
That's the sound of people throwing out their old dehumidifiers. They've replaced them with the energy-saving Wave Ventilation Unit. Wave Ventilation expels moisture, gases, and toxins trapped in your basement or crawl space and replaces it with drier, fresher air. The computerized Wave Ventilation requires no maintenance. There are no buckets to empty, no filters to change. And compared to a dehumidifier, it will save you hundreds of dollars a year in energy costs. One customer wrote,
I was stunned by the difference. I had a dehumidifier for almost 20 years without ever getting rid of that musty smell. And now that smell is finally gone.
Wave can transform your home into a drier, healthier environment. Satisfaction guaranteed. Find out more about Wave Ventilation right now.
For free information, go to goodairnow.com. That's goodairnow.com. Or call 1-866-324-9481. That's 1-866-324-9481.
WRIF's Rockstar Halloween Party. This Friday at the Radisson Livonia. Great prizes for sexiest, scariest, and $500 cash for best overall costume. Full details at WRIF.com. From Bud Light, the sure sign of a good time. Here we go. And 101 WRIF. The Riff. 101 WRIF.
Rock. Yeah, you rock.
The Riff. everything that rocks on the Riff.
Where the saints, there's no sex in your body.